I will bring the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone here. Pinch your neighbor if they do not have green on.
Don't pinch me.
The first order of business would be to approve the minutes of March 12th. Representative Hillstrom, have you had the opportunity to look at the minutes for March 12th?
Yes.
Could you move those?
Yes, Madam Chair. I
The minutes of March 12th have been moved. All those in favor of approving the minutes of March 12th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 742. So if we could have Representative O'Neill come on down. And if Mr. Gehring or if House staff could tell us which parts of House File 742 pertain to our committee, that would be helpful, because we want to focus just on those areas.
Madam Chair and members, there are several sections in this DE7 amendment that relate to data practices, so I'll just walk through them fairly quickly. Section 1 on page 1 is a cross-reference to data related to allegations of sexual assault in Chapter 13. In Section 4 on page 2 in paragraph 8, there's language related to protecting the privacy of sexual assault victims, which includes some data language. On page 3, paragraph 20, this again is in the section requiring institutions to create their new policy related to sexual assault. There's data related to access to student records. On page 4, section 7 is an online reporting system that has some data classifications and data requirements. Section 8 on page 5 also has some data collection and reporting requirements. That runs through line 6.29 on page 6. Section 9 on page 6 is a access to data and audit trail section that requires some accountability and oversight of access to sexual assault incident data. And then, Madam Chair, on page 9, lines 9.5, 9.6, there's an additional classification of data related to data that is shared with a confidential resource.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative O'Neill, I will move House File 742, and do you want to speak to your DE7 amendment?
Thank you. The DE7, after meeting with the stakeholders, we had some clarifying language that we wanted to change and just make sure that it was very clear in the bill. The first change is in the victim rights section, and it further clarifies who can access the data. And so there was a concern as to making sure that only those that had specific job requirements would access that data, and so they changed the language to be very specific so that those who have work assignments that reasonably require access would only have access. It further clarifies that victims can have access to their own description of the event instead of the entire investigatory file, and that had to do with if we allow the victim to have the entire investigatory file, then the accused would also have access, and there was concern as to what would have to be redacted. And so to make that a little bit easier, it was clearly stated in the language that they could have access to their incident report that they created themselves. And the reason that's in the victim rights section is because the victim has to tell her story over and over and over again, and so it was trying to resolve some of that so she wouldn't have to retell her story 10 times, 20 times, whatever it was. And so that was just an ease in the trauma. There's some changes and clarifications under the data collection and reporting section. It further clarifies that the Office of Higher Education must report both statewide data, and so they're going to aggregate all the information all the way up to the state level and then come back down and have information for each individual institution. And because of federal and state law, we also had to add an explanation there that they would explain on their website why they wouldn't be able to report in some institutions because of FERPA. In the comprehensive training section, we clarified who is required to complete the training of sexual assault. We had some questions regarding who actually has to complete the training, because there are so many folks that come in and off of college campuses. They might come for a continuing education class. They might come for other things where that institution really doesn't have a relationship with that person. There's visitors that come and go. So just to clarify that really the people we want to take the training are those that are seeking a degree or a certification, or the PSEO students, And then just to make sure we didn't miss anything, we added a line that said that if the institution believes that there are other categories that need to be added, that they can go ahead and do that. But what we didn't want happening is the institutions being required to provide this training for folks that really don't have a relationship and that institution doesn't have jurisdiction over that person. We also made some changes to the completion of the training. We moved it off of the transcript, which was burdensome and difficult for the institutions, and instead allowed them to come up with their own reporting and proof of completion documentation that will travel with the student. And the final thing that we made a change for was that if a student is enrolled in more than one class or institution of the same system, that they only have to take that requirement one time. We have folks within the Minsky system that might be taking classes 2, 3, 4 different institutions, whether it be online or physically at the campus. And so to relieve that burden off of those particular students, we address that issue with that change. And those are the changes in the current DE7.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. We have a birthday. I think that Representative Bob Vogel, the birthday boy today, would you like to move the DE7?
I'd be pleased to.
Thank you. So the DE7 is before us. Any further discussion on the DE7? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the DE7, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE7 is on the bill, or replaces it, I guess. Representative O'Neill, any further comments that you'd like to make, or would you like your testifier to speak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think at this point I'll turn it over to the testifier, since Mr. Gehring had actually gone through quite a bit of the specific in this bill that you'll be pertaining to.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm actually joined here today by Yvonne Knoyer, who's our Prevention Manager, and she can also help answer any questions. MnCASA is a statewide coalition. We represent 60 sexual assault victim services programs, and many of those programs do work with colleges and universities. I really want to say how pleased we are that there is interest in dealing with the issue of campus sexual assault. We know that it's a problem that should be addressed. I actually looked recently at some campus survey results from my own alma mater, Barnard College, and learned that 20% of the students there said they had been subjected to some sort of unwanted sexual conduct. And so we know this is an issue that comes up in all campuses. We really very much appreciate Representative O'Neill's commitment to this issue. She's been a wonderful partner for us to work with. She's worked closely with us and other stakeholders in order to make sure the bill gets into the shape that you see it today. And I really want to emphasize this has not been an easy bill to pull together. There's a really complex interplay of federal and state law, and also all the campus policies that also come into play. And so it's been a real balancing act, but I think this bill has achieved quite a bit, and we're happy to support all the work that's come into it so far. I would like to direct your attention to some guiding principles that MnCASA has put together on responding to campus sexual assault, and I do believe this bill has met those principles. It is really about victim autonomy, access to advocacy, confidentiality protections, data practices protections, consistent practices, and compatibility with federal law. And then also we want to make sure that there is meaningful training offered. And again, we believe the bill has met all of these requirements. I would like to just offer one small change, and Representative O'Neill is familiar with our consideration in this area before I close. On line 3.29, you will see the word forcible, and we would like to have that word struck. And really the reason is we don't disagree that the Code of Federal Regulations does use that terminology, but that is a term that we're trying to get away from in talking about sexual assault. It's one form of sexual assault, but we certainly know that there are many different ways that sexual assault can manifest itself through coercive activity or if a victim is incapacitated and force isn't needed. The CFR definition, when you look at it more closely, actually does define acts that don't require force. And so really what we're looking to do is to just take that word out of the bill because we know here in our state we do see a broader way of defining sexual assault. We're not asking to use the sexual assault definitions, though, from our criminal sexual conduct code, because that's too confusing. We want to make sure we stick with the CFR definition. But we would just like to have the word removed, for forcible removed, because we do feel it's sort of an old term. And in many ways, our state law is ahead of the federal government in this sense. Again, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and really thank again Representative O'Neill for all of her hard work on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Joelle Stangler. Representative Lesh. Representative Hilstrom, I was hoping to take all the testimony and then have member questions. Is that all right with you?
That's fine, Madam Chair. I just wanted to talk specifically about that definition, and she just testified about it, so
all
whatever
right,
you'd like.
Ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's online 4.5, the definition that you were just speaking of sexual assault with forcible. I just really want to know, for the implications of this bill, if one of the acts occur that Minnesota law classifies as sexual assault, but it isn't defined under federal regulation, under this definition, what happens? What's the school's responsibility? I know they don't have to report it in the same fashion, but what about the wraparound services and the counseling and the other pieces of this bill? Do they still have to provide the services, even if it doesn't meet this definition on 4.5?
Ms. Palmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I'll take a stab at the answer and make sure this is correct, but I believe the school would still have a requirement to respond. It is something that is happened on campus. Many campuses may also have more expansive definitions of sexual assault, too, that could go even broader. So we really want to encourage campuses to create broad policies. Now, they may be limited in what they have to report under the federal government, but they can go as broad as they want on the campus, and we certainly hope that they will.
Representative Hilstrom. Thank you. All right, thank you, Ms. Palmer. Joelle Stangler. Is Joelle here?
She's not here today.
Oh, okay, very good. We'll go to Courtney Blake.
I'm sorry, I don't see them here today. They're U of M students, and
All right.
They're on break,
they
must be.
They probably had a test this morning or something. Member questions for either the previous testifier or Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I want to ask Representative O'Neill what she thinks about the point about forcible, because I do have that concern as well. I'm a prosecutor of domestic and sexual violence, and of course there are so many offenses that don't involve force, so to speak, but would be captured by this. It does seem like including that word forcible is misleading in the statute. So would you accept a friendly amendment to take that word out? What are your thoughts on that? Thank you,
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto. So the reason that word is in there is because if you look clearly at the Clery Act, which is the federal act that the schools have to follow, we wanted to make absolutely sure that we were following their definition so that they didn't have to report two different definitions of what an incident is. And if you look at the Clery report, the Clery definition, there's forcible and non-forcible. And under the non-forcible is things like incest and statutory rape, which don't fit. Everything else that's within our sexual conduct code through 5 is there, with the exception of some stalking language and some other things that are reported outside of this bill, but is reported, so violence and stalking and things like that is reported elsewhere by the schools. And so the only reason that it's there is to clearly say that we're talking about this portion of the federal law. And if you have further questions, I know that Matt Gearing could probably explain that if I've missed anything. So that's the only reason that it's there, I guess, is because if you take the word out, now you've included non-forcible in the definition of Clery, and so that would include statutory rape and incest, which is probably not pertinent to a college campus.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But statutory rape, given that you have PSEO students that are underage, certainly could apply.
It could. We could definitely look at that again. It just, when we were doing the side-by-side comparison and thinking about the population, that gets into, as you know, some other issues as well. But
Representative Hilstrom, follow up? No. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for bringing this bill, Representative O'Neill. As far as that question of forcible language, I feel like it warrants a much broader discussion. I appreciate Minkasa's intent that it's a word that they're trying to get away from. But I know for my purposes, it gets really complicated. This goes right to the heart of a lot of things that we end up debating a lot of times in Public Safety Committee. So if we're going to modify something like that, I feel like I want to hear a lot more testifiers from different perspectives on this before I'm ready to make a decision. So I prefer not to change it right now, at least until we've had that discussion.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. I would concur. That word is a pretty powerful word in the context of this bill, and I think that has to be a global agreement among all the stakeholders whether or not to remove that word or not. Further question, Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, to that point, I do have the institutions that are here. So we have the U of M, Minscu, the private colleges, and I think OHE is here as well, the Office of Higher Ed. I don't know if they would like to weigh in on specifically, because what we're trying to do is report the right information, and I would love to not have that word there, but that word has meaning according to the Clery Act, and so we're trying really hard to align their reporting so they don't have confusing reporting and we have valuable data.
Someone from, call out whoever you would like, Representative O'Neill.
Okay, I think we have a willing participant
okay.
here.
Thank you for coming forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Toya Younger, and I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Madam Chair, Representative, I completely agree. I think the word forcible has a lot of connotations, particularly in the context of this bill. And so we would probably have some issues with removing that with that term as well, particularly, as she said, while our concern has been reporting and having to report in addition to what we already provide to Clery, I do think that forcible really gets to the heart of what Representative O'Neill is trying to address and basically what we have seen on a national level in terms of sexual violence on campus.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Thank you very much. Seeing no further questions from committee members, Representative O'Neill, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 742 as amended to the Higher Ed Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way back to Higher Ed. Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
The next bill we are going to be hearing is 582, House File 582. Representative Anderson, is he in the room? Yeah, there he is. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Anderson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
I will move House File 582 and ask that it be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Anderson, are there any amendments to your bill this morning?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, there are. There were two amendments up on the dais back there, and we're going to be going with the DE3 amendment. That's the later amendment, so I would like to, if you would move for us, please, the DE3 amendment.
All right, the birthday boy, Representative Vogel, will move the DE3, and the DE2 then is a we're just discarding that then?
Yeah, it was just a couple of technical changes from the DE2 to the 3, so the 3 is the most current one.
Here. All right, very good. So the DE3 is before us. To the DE3, Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair. This bill has been brought to us as we see a need here to offer some level of stability and protection to some of our larger feedlots in the state. We already have these protections for small operations in Minnesota, and what this does is extend those protections to some of our larger feedlots. If they follow all the rules currently in place, all the state standards, there would be an assurance here that they would not be subject to a possible nuisance lawsuit. And Madam Chair, I have a testifier who would like to go through some of the changes we've made. This bill was heard in the Ag Policy Committee, and a number of concerns were raised, good concerns, and we have tried to address those in this new amendment, and we'd like to walk you through those if we could, Madam Chair.
Sure. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Jack Perry from the Briggs & Morgan Law Firm. And if I may begin, there's two real major changes that were requested by various members of Representative Anderson's committee. The first one, the most major one, was the initial version of this applied to both pending and future claims, nuisance claims. And various people raised concerns about due process, et cetera, and so the pending was scrapped and this only applies prospectively, which is the normal course. The second change was one that I should have picked up on earlier because it was just poorly drafted and I had played a part in that, so I apologize for that. Is the initial draft of this had step back. There's two bills that are very very similar and essentially should be cross-referenced. That's 116-0713, the livestock odor bill, and then 561.19 subdivision 2. They relate to one another, and so they need to, in fairness to everyone, to know what they're doing, they need to be shown together and the changes shown together. But the besides that, the error that I made in the draft in helping draft the first part was that we put the changes to subdivision 2 right into subdivision 2 rather than what they really belong is to a separate subdivision, which is now subdivision 2B. So if you look at version 3 under subdivision 2B, the additional language is to put a new heading on there and then just to move what was previously in subdivision 2 into subdivision 2B. But the heading tells you the difference in why it was done. 2A is an exemption from nuisance claims. 2B is not an exemption from nuisance cases. All it is based on the legislature's prior laws, there is a minimum threshold standard that needs to be satisfied in order to bring nuisance cases in the state of Minnesota. And this just clarifies that that's what has to happen. For example, in 1967, the legislature passed a law that said that the PCA, which I think they're in the audience here, they were to pass noise standards, statewide noise standards. They were supposed to pass statewide air emission standards, which they did in 1986 and 82, respectively. And in that law in 1967, the legislature said that you can't have local standards which are more stringent. Those are the maximum standards for noise and air emissions. And the natural correlation of that is then it's okay, if you're going to bring a nuisance case, because those are standards that are built for or set by the PCA for nuisance and environmental protection, then you need to bring a nuisance case, you need to at least have a non-compliance with those standards. And so the heading on 2B now reads adverse impact required compliance with state standards. So in other words, if a facility is in compliance with all the noise standards and air emission standards and livestock odor standards, they cannot be sued for nuisance. So it's not an exemption, it is simply a threshold showing that a nuisance complainant or plaintiff must show. Those are the two major changes, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Further discussion on the DE3 amendment. Seeing none, Representative Vogel renews his motion to move the DE3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE3 is now the language in front of us. We do have some more, quite a list of testifiers, and so if the testifiers could limit their testimony to about 2 minutes each, that would be great. The first person I have on the list is Fran Breeder. And Molly Campbell is on deck, if Molly could be ready to go. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fran Breeder. I am
a production manager with Protein Sources, a management company out of based out of Mapleton, Minnesota. I currently am managing a facility up in Todd County, and I was a city kid that grew up in a small town, never got really into agriculture, and through a family member was introduced to animal agriculture, and I've really enjoyed the work that we do. I'm currently moved up to Osakis, Minnesota to manage this facility, and have really was very excited about the opportunity to, it's a new state-of-the-art facility with the newest technologies, and I had the opportunity to train local residents to manage this facility in the long term. And what it's really done is it's created an environment where we've got local folks that are able to, instead of moving off and finding jobs in other areas, they stay local and stay in the communities they grew up in and make these small communities thrive. This facility is, like I said, one of a kind, and we've done, the management company I work for, we have over 250 years of knowledge, of experience that went into the thought processes of how this facility was built, with and obviously following all the local, the state, and the government regulations was the main key. And they've done a very fine job of that, and it's one of a kind. So any questions you would have for me, I would be happy to entertain them.
Thank you. Mr. Breiter, did I say that
right? Yes, Breiter. Yep.
We're going to hear from all the testifiers, then stand by if there are any questions. We will certainly address those to you.
Will
Thank
do.
You so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Campbell and Delvin Durheim is from Todd County Livestock Board is next. Hi, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Molly Campbell. I am a current employee at the Gorley Family Farms in Long Prairie, Minnesota. I work there as the farrowing manager, and I very much so enjoy my job because I get to take care of the sows that are giving birth, as well as the newly born piglets and the piglets that are up to wean age, which is roughly 21 days. And I find this job very enjoyable. And sadly, in our area, opportunities that arise are very limited, where you enjoy your job, you have the wages that you need, the benefits that you need, and also the hours that you need. And before I was employed with the Gorleys, I was working two different jobs with none of these benefits, and I was barely making ends meet between bills, house payments, mortgage payments, such as this. And the Gorleys really gave me that opportunity to spend more time with my family, working better hours, spend more time enjoying life, and they've really taken a lot of stress off me and my family. And I just really want to show my appreciation and thanks to them for giving me or opening up these opportunities, not only to me but also to my community, and making me stay more local instead of having to drive down to St. Cloud, which is in Stearns County. I can stay in Todd County and really support my community in a financial way, and just being there for everyone that I need to be with.
Great. I know that can be a dangerous job. Those sows aren't always the friendliest when they're with their pigs. I guess thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to Mr. Durheim. I hope I have that name right. And then Paul Fitzsimmons is the next testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue
my name
your testimony.
My name is Delvin Durheim, and I also am from Todd County. One of my responsibilities there, I'm involved in some local government issues, and one of my appointments is I was appointed to the Todd County Livestock Advisory Council, which is there are persons appointed by each of the commissioner districts. Our area is very rural. Our population is only approximately 25,000 people, and agriculture has been the number one industry there for many, many years, specifically livestock production. Our area is not really conducive to strong crop production, so how most of the people in our area for ag production have made use of their crops is through the livestock industry. That is where they've garnered their basis of their income. certainly this was a welcome opportunity to our area to have a facility such as the Gorleys come in there, because it did offer a huge economic benefit to our area, not only in employment, but for some of the other issues that were brought in, such as local construction and those types of things as well. The now with the new facilities that we now use has certainly changed the outcome and the way things are done. It's business as usual. We were a strong dairy operation prior to this. Dairy industry has dwindled somewhat, and we've now gone to larger facilities, which have become more efficient. But one of the reasons that they have become larger is because of our aging population. There is not a lot of people coming forth to take the place of the people that are retiring. So what is happening is facilities are becoming larger. They've become one person is buying out two or three older people that no longer are able to continue on in that business. So consequently, facilities get larger. But because of that, they also become much more efficient. And especially with the use of technology. Again, if I just cannot emphasize enough how much the economic benefit has been for hiring of local people to come in and work in these facilities. It certainly has offered some huge opportunities for some people that were not gainfully employed in the past. It is with our advisory council, we work very strongly with our local enforcement people. One of the people that is a member of our livestock advisory is our local feedlot officer. So we keep in close contact with that person as well. So we try to watch all the situations that are coming, positive or negative, and certainly encourage the positive outcomes, which I think is what we are headed for in our area very strongly.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
You are welcome.
Please stand by if there are any questions later.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzsimmons is at the table, and David Priesler, Minnesota Pork Producers, is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Paul Fitzsimmons from Mapleton, Minnesota. And I want to say top of the morning, I'm a little hoarse today, but I truly am Irish. And I come from a 20-generation family farm, because my father, who was Irish, would think that time spent in Ireland would count also. So that's why I'm going to say 20th. So I got a family farm. I'm one of nine siblings. All nine of us work together at our management company, and we own sow facilities ourselves. We also manage for other farmers. And of those other farmers, and everything gets lumped into what's large, what's not. So we manage 35,000 sows in and around southern Minnesota, Iowa. Of those 35,000 sows, there are 82 family owners that are in there. As they get spread out, they go back to the families to finish them through market. So, and I brought Fran and Molly along, and they represent the people that work in these facilities. We have about 280 employees, and I think Molly and Fran represent the fabric of what these facilities bring into rural America, in rural Minnesota, southern Minnesota. So if we were to go across southern Minnesota, there's as many sows in ownership in southern Minnesota than there is probably anywhere else in the U.S. And so it is the fabric, as these people are woven into the small towns and communities across southern Minnesota. As an industry, I know we understand the role we play in the environment and the resources. And we are committed to do the best. And I think back in 97, when this law was passed with bipartisan support, it was intended to help farmers get some certainty in their operations. One thing we can't live with is the uncertainty of going through 2 years of township, county, Minnesota Pollution Control doing an EAW, and then coming back and putting those operations, spending millions of dollars in operations, getting animals, livestock in, getting the people in place, and then having lawsuits that are brought, even though we meet every standard that we were judged by coming in. So the uncertainty of this is leaving us in a place where I have three or four projects that are on the board I don't think going forward that I could go on with those projects in Minnesota if we don't have some certainty that somebody down the road is not going to come back at us, even though we follow all the standards in which we were judged by to begin with. So, we face a new problem in the industry. And the industry is being faced with outside forces that are coming into Minnesota. And somebody said, you know, is the wolf at the door? No, the wolf is in the room. And that wolf is looking for ways to hinder the Minnesota livestock operations, and it doesn't matter what size. The size limit is in there, that will disappear also. So we need to have that certainty. And I think Minnesota producers across the board have worked since 97 to put money in. We've self-funded research along with the University of Minnesota. The Pollution Control have worked closely with them and the DNR to make sure that these facilities are all not only compliant but are way under the standards. And that's all come through a lot of producer on every species hard work over the last 10, 15 years.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzsimmons. Please, thank you for your testimony. Please stand by for questions. David Preisler, or Priestler, and then Bron Scherer is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and if you could, please try to limit your testimony to 2 minutes.
Will do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Preisler. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. And on behalf of Minnesota farmers who raise pigs for a living, we ask for your support for the amended House File 582. Like was stated before, we're committed to compliance with state standards, and really what this bill is really rewards that compliance. This bill doesn't change state standards or enforcement of environmental rules. It again just provides some certainty. Briefly, really what's at stake is that if we look at Minnesota agriculture, it brings $21 billion to Minnesota's economy each year. 40% of that $21 billion comes from livestock. And so if we have threats that are in place, especially from lawsuits that are really unfounded but unfortunately very expensive, it really creates a risk for that 40% of that $21 billion worth of income that it provides for Minnesota farmers and actually for the state. I'll finish up by making sure that you know that it's not just the pork producers that support this. We also have gotten the support from the Minnesota cattlemen's, Minnesota milk producers, turkey growers, chicken and eggs, corn growers, soybean growers, Farm Bureau, wheat and barley. And so there's a broad coalition that's actually in favor of this. It is not just something related to hog farms. This is related to all farms. And the reason it's important to crop farms is that really the livestock farms are the market for these crops. And without livestock farms, it really puts crop farms at risk. So with that, thank you for your time. And again, we'd appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Preisler, for your testimony. Next is Bron Scherer, and on deck, Amy Goodwin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Bron Scherer. I'm a CPA and partner with Mr. Fitzsimmons and Protein Sources. We founded the company in the mid-90s. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, and worked as a public accountant at Arthur Anderson in the 80s, and have been on my own consulting, and also I'm a pork producer, own real estate in pork, and advise independent farmers in Minnesota and other parts of the country. I echo Mr. Fitzsimmons' testimony, and we've lived it. There is a litigation ongoing with respect to the Gourley site, and I think for your purposes and being barraged with the information and the amount that you have to sift through, I would encourage you to look at that lawsuit and also to look at the MPCA website and look at the Gourley Brothers EAW, the environmental assessment worksheet that was prepared with significant resources, and again, is a necessary and part of starting and developing a feedlot. You'll hear testimony, I think, that gives the impression that God knows what the picture is that you'll think of when you think of what this feedlot looks like. I would encourage you, and again, you're busy, I would encourage anyone to go up and look at that site, stand at the property line, and tell me that it appears is not a professional and a state-of-the-art modern facility that also went through modeling, including odor modeling, that we paid for with the MPCA, to address the needs of the neighbors. I grew up in Martin County, one or two or three, I don't know where it ranks now, most pig-dense counties in the United States. Grew up on a family farm. I live on Northfield, but I'm on the edge of a significant turkey barn facility, so I know all about animal agriculture. But the Gorleys are painted as an out-of-staters, corporate farmers. Again, these are multi-generational, independent family farmers that could frankly make a living a lot easier ways. I could too, but we love animal livestock. We've been in it for generations. It provides those jobs that were talked about by Molly and Fran. But none of that's important if we damage the environment, and that's not the case. There's no better environmental stewards as a group than livestock producers and swine producers in this state in particular. We're leaders in the world, and that facility in Todd County, which, you know, again, we focus on here, but it's a broader issue, but this is a classic case where we're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars defending this frivolous lawsuit, and the nuisance is on our side. And for what? What are our recourse when we win? There are outside groups, as Mr. Fitzsimmons reported, that have never been on a farm. They're from the East Coast. We're fighting dozens of attorneys whose goal is not, they don't care about the neighbors. They don't care about animals. They don't care about our industry. They don't care about our employees. They care about eliminating animal livestock in the United States of America. And that's not just the Humane Society. There are others as well. So with that, I'm proud to be a part of this industry. It's key to the vitality of rural Minnesota and the economic activity and the ability, frankly, for both parties to spend money. Here at the we pay a lot of taxes, we pay a lot of fees. Without animal agriculture in this state, I shudder to think what rural Minnesota would be like. And once it's gone, it does not come back. I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that testimony. Mr. Perry, were you wanting to testify again?
I did, if I can.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I crossed you out because I thought we've heard from you. Go ahead.
I thought maybe you were giving me a hint.
No, go ahead. If you could keep your testimony to 2 minutes, that would
I
be
can do it
awesome.
Short of that, I think. If I can approach, I give it to
We have a page here that I think could handle that for you.
Madam Chair, I have two handouts.
So introduce yourself again.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's Jack Perry from the Briggs & Morgan Law Firm. And I have two handouts. I'm not going to go through them, but for those like me who like to know a little more about what you're doing, a little more background, I know there's some lawyers in this committee. The first one is a four-point explanation as to how we got to this point. And the second one is a chart that goes through from Representative Anderson's committee. There were nine different concerns that we were able to piece together that were presented, and some of those concerns we were already addressed with the changes. The other concerns are addressed not by my attempt to persuade, but by actual legislation and Minnesota rules. So the stuff on this chart, left is the concerns that were raised in front of his committee, and the right is statutory comments and rules that specifically address those concerns. What this boils down to, really simple, is the opponents of these facilities want to apply a subjective test. If a subjective test applies, that means a jury is going to be asked, does it smell too much? No other parameters, no standards are applicable. In 1997 and 2000, I have read the entire legislative history of what bipartisan group put together, and you created standards to address livestock odor. And you said there are hundreds of different components that make up livestock odor, but we are going to pick out hydrogen sulfide and say this is the proxy because that's the closest approximation we have. And that's what took place in 1997-2000. And all we're asking for is that objective standard is applied for nuisance cases, or where there's noise, this is the noise standard, but the standards that are created by the Pollution Control Agency apply to these facilities. And the reason we need that is not just these lawsuits, but how do you invest, how do you get people to invest if they don't know what the rules of the game are? And if people complain, say the standards aren't high enough, go to the PCA and change the standards. We can't profess to what the standards should be. All we're doing is we're a businesses that want to operate in this state under a set of guidelines that we can comply with. And that's it, objective versus subjective. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Perry, for your testimony. Ms. Goodwin is next, and then Doug Ayers. I probably botched that, but you're on deck. Ayers. Ms. Goodwin, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Amy Goodwin. excuse me, I also have a frog in my throat this morning, allergies and our wonderful early spring. Madam Chair and committee, thank you very much for hearing my testimony today. I'm not here representing a big facility or a business. I'm here representing the people. I live next to the facility that Fran Brider spoke of in Todd County. My family has lived in that place for almost 20 years. My husband and I moved there after we were married, and we built our home there. We had all of our children there and carved out, you know, our home and our life there and intended on retiring there. And my children, you know, already joked about, you know, who got it when mom and dad left. You know, that was our plan. We have four sons. When we first heard about this facility coming to Todd County, we were not against this facility in any way. We were very involved in agriculture. My husband grew up on a large dairy farm. We have two neighbors that are hog farmers within a mile of our home, and agriculture is a part of what we love about where we live, and it's a part of our lives. So we were not against this in any way. It wasn't until I started hearing the concerns of some of the other neighbors that I became a little bit concerned. I'm a writer, I'm an author, and I do a lot of research in my career, and so I started doing my own research. And the things that I came across, I came across several things that were a little disturbing, but the thing that concerned me the most was the effects that these facilities can have on people with respiratory issues. That concerned me because I have two children with asthma, and I have asthma myself. So this facility was built in an area in Todd County where there are six homes within a half a mile of this facility. And this is a large facility. It's one of a kind, just as you've heard. and that's awful close to six homes. My home was a little over 2,000 feet away from this facility, and I was the fourth farthest away. So that gives you a picture of how many neighbors were closer than I was. So we gathered and went to our local government. We went through all the correct steps. We went to the Livestock Committee. We went to our commissioners. We went to planning and zoning. We did everything we could to try to, legally from what we could do, to just try to say, hey, this isn't a great site. We're not against this, you know, coming to Todd County. We're not against the jobs that it's going to bring. We're not against what you're doing. But this is too close to our children, and it's going to make them sick, and we're afraid it's going to make them sick. We were met with closed doors. It was very quickly turned into a battle of, oh, you're against agriculture, which it's not, which we are not. So eventually we did go to the MPCA. We did go to everywhere we needed to go, and doors opened for these facility owners, and eventually the CUP went through. And we were pretty devastated. We didn't want to leave our home. We knew that that was going to be probably a possibility, and that's why we fought so hard to keep them out. We loved our home. We didn't want to leave our home. And so we decided that we would just wait and see what happened. So the facility was built, and the hogs were brought in probably, I think the facility was finished in June, and hogs, I think, were brought in July or August. And very quickly, we started to notice signs in our younger son, whose asthma is a little more severe than our older son's. He started needing his inhaler regularly, which wasn't the case before. And it was really a very short time, a matter of months, until he was completely dependent on steroid nebulizers to keep him breathing freely. The attack came for him eventually, sometime I think in December, that he had such an attack that all the medicine we had given him wasn't working. His lips turned blue. And I can't tell you what that does to a parent if you've not experienced it. I hope you haven't. It's a horrible thing to experience, to see the panic in your child's eyes when he cannot breathe. And that was the night that my husband and I quit fighting to stay in our home, because home was not a safe place for our son. We put our house up for sale. We risked financial ruin and bought another home to get our son away from there. Within a very short time, all of my children who had developed hacky coughs, their coughs cleared once we got them away from there. And it was a horrible stress on our family. It has been incredibly stressful on my children to leave their home. And we've all had our breakdowns about it. And my 13-year-old has sobbed over his home. And when he says, why did this happen to us? I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know why this happened to us. I'm sure that in Minnesota, in fact, I know because I've talked with them, that there are hog facility owners and big facility farmers that are honest in their dealings, and they do everything that they can to work with their community around them, but that was not the case for us. And that's how we ended up in this situation. The truth is that my family isn't the only family that's been affected. All of the neighbors that are the closest have been affected. And there are neighbors and there are people in Todd County clearly who do not care about this situation because they are not affected by it. But we are. And we went through all the correct channels to get help, and no one would help us. And that's how we got where we are. I'm asking you today to please stop this bill. Our situation is a perfect example of what can happen when the power is taken away from the people. And that is what this bill will do. It will take away the power for us to defend ourselves. These facilities, there are states that require these facilities as law to be at least a mile away from all residents, a mile. Six homes within a half a mile. What this situation really needs is a hero. And we need somebody to be strong enough and courageous enough to stand up and say, we will not let you treat Minnesotans in this way. That there are standards that need to be upheld. I don't know how you feel about this situation. I don't know what way you're leaning, but I hope that today you will stand with us. And in so doing, you will be standing with Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ayers, and on deck, Patrick Hines.
I have handouts as well.
Okay.
Should I?
You can give those to the page will be right with you. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ayers. Did I get that right?
You did.
All right. Introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony. If you could keep it brief, that would be great.
Yes. Madam Chair and distinguished members of the House Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, I did strike some lines from my testimony today to brief it up a little bit in the interest of time here. My name is Douglas Ayers, and I represent Dodge County Concerned Citizens. We're a southern Minnesota nonprofit citizens group concerned about rural issues. We're not against agriculture, and we're not against animal agriculture, since most of our group lives in rural Dodge County. But we do not believe HF 582 is a good bill for Minnesota. Dodge County in southern Minnesota is a heavy animal agriculture county. It has a population of just over 20,000 people, and we have 85,000 animal units, quickly approaching 100,000 animal units, the majority of which are swine held in large swine barns. We also have turkey barns, and we have a few dairy feedlots. With 85,000 animal units in our county already, our county produces the animal manure equivalent of 800,000 people. 85,000 animal units produces like 800,000 people, that much manure. And we only have 20,000 human residents in our county. My in-laws, Lowell and Evelyn Trom of Blooming Prairie, operate a grain farm growing primarily corn and soybeans in Dodge County. Despite strong local opposition, our county recently approved a new 2,400-head swine barn 1.5 mile from my in-laws' farm. This was the 11th permitting of swine barns within a 3-mile radius of their farmhouse, and it's now surrounded on every direction by swine barns. The annual manure produced by one facility, 2,400 feeder pigs, is equivalent to a town of 7,000 people moving in next door to your farmhouse. That's how much manure gets produced. Over 1 million gallons of liquid manure is produced in this one facility annually, and it will be spread on nearby topsoil, often near creeks and streams. We have 5 major watersheds that run out of our county. 2 flow directly toward the city of Rochester, 2 flow into Goodhue County, and 1 flows directly through the city of Austin. We worry about manure runoff into these watersheds with so much animal manure now being produced in our county. The manure pits and manure spreading creates a significant odor nuisance to the neighbors who have to live near these facilities. Amy testified to this, what it's like. Despite very strong local opposition to another swine project near my farm several years ago, the county approved that operation too. You see, in Dodge County, on these issues, the county board is controlled by large feedlot interests. The county has never denied a new feedlot permit in our county to anyone. The county initially permitted one swine barn on this site. Then they later allowed a second swine barn, and then a third went in. Once the three swine barns were up, the farm owner and his wife, who lived on the property, moved away to a new house 3 miles away. The neighbors couldn't move, but the owner moved away. It's not easy for neighbors to bring a nuisance claim in district court against a large feedlot operator, as it usually is only filed as a last resort. Nuisance claims typically do not garner significant financial windfalls to the plaintiffs. A favorable outcome only results in a court ordering the feedlot operator to abate the nuisance. For example, the court will require the owner to install biofilters on their buildings to mitigate odor issue. If the legislature approves HF 582, you would deny families like my father-in-law and other neighbors the opportunity to file a nuisance claim against a large feedlot operator. You will limit their day in court. Several members of this committee are attorneys, and this bill removes a right to litigate. You're taking away a right to litigate against a large feedlot. These are rural citizen neighbors who have already been marginalized on the front end due to the steamrolling of large new feedlot permits being approved by the county. HF 582 would largely silence them on the back end and limit their ability to ever challenge a feedlot operator with a nuisance claim in district court. I believe this bill protects powerful feedlot interests in our state and is unfair to the rural feedlot neighbors that have to live by the facilities. I urge you to vote against this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Ayers. Patrick Hines and then Stephen Carpenter. Again, folks, if you could please limit your testimony. We've got two more bills to hear after this one. Yes, you can, yeah. If you're splitting your time, you each get a minute. I only had one person on the list. Go ahead, Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League is concerned with the impact that this bill would have on the ability of local units of government to bring public nuisance claims. As you know, nuisance claims are generally disputes between private property owners, both of whom want the full use and enjoyment of their property. And oftentimes, it's the local unit of government who is the first entity that's going to deal with these type of disputes. And while public nuisance claims aren't common, they are an important tool if a local unit of government can't see an issue resolved any other way. That's why, in our opinion, that the public nuisance, the ability to bring a public nuisance claim was originally exempted from many of the provisions of the underlying law. And we don't see that there's a need to change the underlying law today. Regarding the DE3 amendment, the new language in Subdivision 2B directly conflicts with the language in Subdivision 2 of the existing law. So you're creating a conflict that either makes the existing law a nullity or at the very least creates ambiguity and litigation over whether an agricultural operation is not a public nuisance under the new language, or if there's a rebuttable presumption that it has to meet if it is under the old language. So we think that conflict creates a lot of problems. But also note that in the existing law, it says after 2 years an agricultural operation is not a nuisance if it meets certain standards. That law does not apply to swine facilities over 1,000 animal units, and it doesn't apply to cattle operations over 2,500 animal units. The new language in Subdivision 2B does not have that exception, so it would be a change from the current policy that the state has adopted. And finally, I would note that on lines 2.27 to 2.30, that's new Subdivision 2BA, that language is not tied to any of the PCA standards that are referenced later in the bill, so it is a much more general statement about what can and cannot be a nuisance. and it uses the phrase no measurable adverse impact, which I don't believe is defined elsewhere in statute, and is a very broad language. It would be very difficult to meet that standard, in our opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And we are in agreement with Mr. Hines. Our reading of the DE3 would render current law, our two-year window of saying that there is a problem, even if they're meeting standards, there's still a public nuisance problem, renders that section of law meaningless because you're having a section that out says it shall not be, period. No exceptions, no waivers, no look back. It just is not a suit that can be brought under the new sections of 2B. And so it renders the current law completely meaningless for any practical enforcement. And it is a great expansion by the fact that it now applies to any form of animal agriculture versus just operations under 1,000. So with those two things, we look forward to working with Representative Anderson. I worked with him after his committee hearing a week ago, and we're hoping to find a solution to bring back that look-back period, but it does not exist in the current bill.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Stephen Carpenter and Bobby King is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and if you could keep your testimony to 2 minutes, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Carpenter. I am an attorney at Farmers Legal Action Group, a nonprofit law firm here in Minnesota that has worked on behalf of family farmers for decades. I've worked at FLAG since 1993, and I guess I might as well just go ahead and say I grew up on a dairy farm too, so I don't really hate agriculture in general, but we have some concerns about this bill. I'd like to focus my testimony on what I think are the four most important ways in which this bill changes the current statute, and I'd like to talk just briefly about the possibility that the bill itself is unconstitutional. The bill changes the way Minnesota's right to farm law works. The four most important ways that it changes them, part of them have been mentioned. Number one is that it essentially gives a livestock operation a free pass if it follows the official regulations and rules that the state provides. One of the things that assumes, therefore, is that the agencies that regulate these operations have an adequate budget, operate quickly, and essentially make no mistakes. Because at present, if any of those things go wrong, the neighbors still have the option to file a nuisance lawsuit. This bill assumes that those entities never make mistakes, essentially. I would note as well that the effect of following the regulations doesn't cut both ways. That is to say, the bill provides significant opportunities for operations not to follow the statute, but still gain immunity under the bill. So in other words, if they do meet all the regulations, they're immune, but if they don't, they might be immune still. The second biggest change that I would note is, was briefly alluded to previously, is the measurable adverse impact standard. You'll notice that under the bill, no one can be sued for nuisance unless they can show there is a measurable adverse impact. That, of course, is not defined in the bill. And what that means is that even if an operation did not follow the relevant rules and regulations applicable, if the plaintiffs couldn't prove a measurable adverse impact, the operation is immune from a nuisance lawsuit. So even if they don't follow the rules, they still get protected. The third biggest thing that we would argue changes with this bill is the reduction of local control. You just heard people testify that both public nuisance and planning and zoning powers are reduced for the localities. That completely eliminated those rights which exist at present and which are protected under the current statute. The fourth biggest change that occurs in the bill would be that you create additional important loopholes for odor. The entire regulation, as it exists now, takes odor and defines it as hydrogen sulfide. That's the only way the odor gets regulated according to the bill and according to the way that people would be protected from nuisance lawsuits. Unfortunately, as scientists have noted, hydrogen sulfide is not the sole source of odor. There's a National Academy of Sciences study that argues that there are 330 compounds in hog manure that cause odor. In other words, if you were able to meet the hydrogen sulfide state requirements, your farm could not be sued for nuisance even if all of the other additives and chemical elements that caused the odor were present in high quantities, created an immense nuisance, you still couldn't be sued. Those, Madam Chair, are the four most important ways that it seems that the statute changes current law. The current law protects the vast majority of farms in Minnesota from nuisance lawsuits to a quite significant degree. This bill would give them essentially a free pass and apply to even the largest operations. My final point would be that there is a constitutional question regarding the bill. The state of Iowa passed, as all 50 states have done, a form of a right to farm law. The Iowa Supreme Court, however, ruled that once you start taking away people's power to file a nuisance lawsuit, what you have done is take away their property rights. Nuisance is your ability to protect your own property from other people interrupting your enjoyment of it. If the state legislature decides that I cannot protect my property in order to make good use of it, Iowa Supreme Court ruled that when the state legislature does that, they have taken away one of my constitutional rights under the Fifth Amendment to not have my property taken without compensation. No one knows what Minnesota courts would do, but you have a very uneven result in courts across the country, but it is an important and open question. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Next up, Bobby King, and then Joel Carlson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Again, try to keep it brief.
Madam Chair, my name is Bobby King. I am with the Land Stewardship Project. We're a farm and rural organization that works to promote a family farm-based system of agriculture. Many of our farmer members raise livestock, and we're actively engaged in promoting more livestock on the land. I want to say first that the overwhelming majority of farmers are covered by the existing law, and this bill unnecessarily broadens that protection to the very largest producers. And it's not a matter of, just to put it in perspective, 1,000 animal units is 2,400 sows. Most hog producers are under that limit. So the majority of producers are currently covered by our existing law, which is working well. I mean, really, we've only had one case come forward complaining about the law, one hog entity. I don't know of any other industry that asked for this kind of extraordinary weakening of neighbors' rights to operate. And I do think most farmers take pride in getting along with their neighbors and, in fact, don't want or need this type of protection. And it's just a very few cases where a proposer insists on pushing forward despite very valid concerns from neighbors when these problems arise. The one particular about the law I wanted to speak a little bit more to was the hydrogen sulfide issue. Hydrogen sulfide standards are based on health concerns. Hydrogen sulfide at long-term low-level exposures is a health problem. So our standard is based on health concerns. It's very different from odor. And you can be in compliance with the hydrogen sulfide law and really, really be giving up obnoxious odor because you're not using biofilters, because you're not using windbreaks, because you're not using pit additives. You're not doing the things that most other operators do to get along with neighbors. So we feel that in particular is inappropriate. And that in general, this legislation gives the very largest operators the ability to harm neighbors without appropriate accountability. And in fact, that is bad for the livestock industry when you give people that kind of power. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Mr. Carlson and finally John Hottinger will be the final testifier. Good morning, Mr. Carlson. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and if you could keep your comments brief, that would be much appreciated.
I will, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And our members come to the Capitol to advocate for the legal, constitutional rights of Minnesotans and their right to trial by jury. And this particular measure goes far afield from where the current law exists. Madam Chair and members, I think we need to look at what nuisance is. And it's defined in statute 56101. And a nuisance is anything that is injurious to your health, indecent or offensive, an obstruction to the free use of your property, and that is to so to interfere with the comfortable enjoyment of life or property, and that is a nuisance. That's been the law in Minnesota since, I believe, at least 1905. So for 110 years, we've had a right to bring about a claim to abate a nuisance. These aren't damage cases. These are people that have to go to court to get an operator to essentially comply with community standards. And it hasn't been said, but you need to know that the activity doesn't need to be illegal to be a nuisance. Compliance here is not the issue. And quite frankly, as others have said, in Minnesota, there is no policy on odor. And we used to have one. And the PCA repealed it in 1998. And they have no policy right now on odor. And the one of the reasons the PCA testified in the Ag Committee that they eliminated the odor standard is, one, it is subjective and it is community-based. And number two, we felt comfortable eliminating that because citizens had the right to bring a nuisance claim when there are problems that need to be addressed. We believe this legislation eliminates that right in a way that is completely unfair for residents because it is based upon issues that you could not ever prove. I would also point out, Madam Chair and members, if you look at the bill, and I appreciate the testimony and agree with the testimony of the League of Cities, the townships, and the others that have presented here, but I want to add one additional point. Throughout the language of this bill, if you look at lines, or the DE3, 2.13, 2.28, and throughout the bill, you will notice that they use the term that these facilities will not be considered a nuisance as a matter of law. That's a term of art, members. That means you do not get to talk to a jury. You do not get to talk to a jury of your peers about the nuisance conditions that you're experiencing. This eliminates your right to a trial by jury, a basic constitutional right, and we have serious concerns about it. Madam Chair and members, happy to answer questions, but this is a serious departure in the law from where we've been, and I hope you will seriously consider the consequences of approving this bill. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair
you, Mr.
and members.
Carlson.
And this is the happiest St. Patrick's Day I think I've ever had. It's the lonely at this table. We've had awesome witnesses that are on the side of justice this time, and I really appreciate it. It's been great. Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Thank
you. Mr. Hottinger. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and association, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Hottinger. I'm here representing the Sierra Club, North Star Chapter, the leading grassroots voice to preserve and protect Minnesota's environment with over 14,000 members. Now, Minnesota's environment needs protection, but so do the people impacted by Minnesota's environment. I have a lengthy piece of testimony that has been done much better by more recent witnesses, so I'm not going to repeat any of them except to give my agreement with witnesses who have appeared before you from the League of Cities and the townships, from the Law Center, folks who have actually talked about what this law is. It's always a good idea to be skeptical when a proposed bill is brought to you to try and alter a current court case. That was one of the most problematic things in this bill, and I thank the author for making sure this is not retroactive. But it still closes the door to the courthouse for many viable folks who have complaints about nuisance. And we all know the major economic impact of agriculture. But we also have to we also have protections for the property rights of people and the people rights who are impacted negatively by irresponsible circumstances. There's been a somewhat tentative balance on that issue for 10 to 15 years now. For allowing one lawsuit to impact us, and the witnesses talked about that lawsuit. I didn't know anything about that lawsuit. is not a good way to approach policy. The defects in the bill from a legal standpoint, most of you can clearly see, I hope, after listening to this testimony. But let me end with one final thing, and that's a reaffirmation of what Mr. Carlson just told you. This bill takes away from the normal judicial process of resolving viable disputes by eliminating whole ranges of people from any recourse for a damaging neighbor. And the Sierra Club would ask for your consideration and to not pass this bill, upsetting the balance of power and the relationships between agriculture and people who live near it.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. A couple of questions from members. Representative Lesh. If there's a specific testifier you'd like to hear from, feel free to call them to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just from hearing all the testimony, I think this bill warrants more than a couple questions. But my question is for the author. Representative Anderson, about half the testifiers we heard from testified specific to these Goerli pork producers, with whom I'm not familiar. Is this a bill for one business, or if not, why? I mean, we heard from trade groups, but a lot of the testimony seems to impact a specific lawsuit related to a specific business. Now, is this a proxy fight for? I mean, this lawsuit a proxy fight for larger issues in the legal community? Which may very well be the case, but why is all of this focusing on one business?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative, as I understand, there are currently three lawsuits pending in Minnesota under this heading of nuisance lawsuits, and I believe the Goerli location was one of them, and that's why we took out pending cases from our first appearance in my Ag Policy Committee. So a lot of the testimony was on that particular operation, but being the language has been changed to only look ahead, to look down the road and not look at pending lawsuits, that would, as I understand, wouldn't be affected by this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of my questions relate to the fact that you got heads of trade groups, you brought your lawyer from your big law firm, you got an accountant in here, and so it causes me to question, it looks to me like kind of a David and Goliath issue. Now, I'm willing to bet on the other side someone would say, no, these small property owners adjacent to these farms are funded by some big groups or something. I bet you that's what I'd hear, but I haven't heard a lot about that today. Regardless, let me ask another question, Representative Anderson. If I buy a house next to one of these farms, and I have a situation like Ms. Goodwin testified to, where my sons are suffering respiratory issues, and your bill says that you have to have some measurable impact, okay, is my kids hacking and having respiratory issues, is that enough measurable impact for you under the terms of this bill?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative, if there were some valid medical claim, I would assume yes, but it would have to be a doctor's decision or whatever that would be possible. But again, if I could just add, a lot of the testimony about that site and other possibilities has to do with siting. And to me, siting is a local issue, a planning and zoning county board issue, and those things should be addressed in the permitting process in terms of a location next to a house that you or anybody else may own. And that's a local issue that I think would be addressed, should be addressed in the permitting process.
Well,
Madam Chair, I think local authorities do try to address this stuff in the permitting process. But let me tell you, my first political job was in 1999, and I worked for a Ward 2 city council member. And a lot of folks had some good ideas to get together. They thought it'd be a great idea to stick an ethanol plant in the middle of an urban area. And you, for anyone's purposes, they thought it was a good idea. And Gopher State Ethanol opened up at the old Schmidt Brewery down there on West 7th Street. And it was great because, you know, jobs came in and we were going to get an industry going that had been shuttered, really. Well, I happened to be the legislative aide for the Ward 2 council member the day that thing opened. And my phone rang nonstop for months. And all the permitting processes had been hit. All the I's had been dotted and all the T's had been crossed. But that didn't let up the people down there from organizing. And they were told they met all the standards. The PCA signed off on it. Everything's good. These people started going down to Bloomington to the owner's house and sabotaging his cars and his house because they had no recourse. And I wonder if that's what we're saying, if we're saying you don't have access to the courts. If your kids are hacking at night a week after this thing opens next to you, what kind of option are we giving them if we don't give them an option to a jury? Madam Chair, you know, I know that we went long on this bill, and you don't have a lot of time, but I have a lot more questions about what exactly this is doing, about how it's tied to either a specific business or specific industry. I don't know why ag should receive this benefit. Why shouldn't we give it to the ethanol producers down on West 7th? To force them to show measurable impacts, which was hard for these people to do down on West 7th. Or, for example, when I was a kid driving down to South St. Paul, and the wind came in from the east on occasion, and the stench from those rendering plants floated up from the river that provided jobs for the town of South St. Paul. And my dad always laughed and said, ah, the smell clears the sinuses, and we'd all be rolling up our windows. It's horrible. Now, the people in South St. Paul, those had been there for 100 years. So they got used to it, and no one who moved in there, and then all of a sudden a rendering plant opened. But it seems to me that you're allowing ham producers to be ham-fisted in how they run their operations if they don't have to be subject to the same kind of accountability for their mistakes as any other industry does. So, Madam Chair, I have a lot more questions, but I suspect we don't have time for it in committee. I hope to God there can be some fix for this. Where is this going from here, Madam Chair?
Representative Lesh, this is going to Environment and Natural Resources.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, when I think about this particular bill, I think about my community, and 3M is down there. And, you know, decades ago, our city council at the time, long before I was probably born, said, hey, it's okay to have this incinerator here. So they truck in all the hazardous waste from all their plants all over the country, and basically they got carte blanche to do this forever because of the agreement. And so how does this affect the future? And so if the MPCA says, well, we need lower limits, we've learned that this actually causes more health hazards than it doesn't, does the producer have to agree by that, or do they have to... are they grandfathered for the future?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Schoen. This bill doesn't address the standards in terms of where they are. And if we need tougher standards, if we need to have a smell test for ammonia, for example, let's do that. But currently there isn't. So I think you have to understand the predicament a producer is in if they fulfill all of the current requirements and yet then are subject to a nuisance lawsuit. But to a short answer, if the standards change, then the producer must meet those new standards. This bill does not grandfather anybody in. It just says follow the standards that are in place, whatever they may be, and if you do that, you would not be subject to a nuisance lawsuit.
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, so... and that's a thank you for that answer. I guess what other industry do we do this for? And when I say industry, I mean how that this is particularly carved out in this way. I mean, I grew up a farm kid out in Murdoch, Minnesota, and we had, you know, every now and then we'd have 20, 30 hogs in the barn or something, and that was family farm. I mean, this is industry. This is not the same as the family farm. Now, I would say that, you know, you do need to be bigger because you feed more families in that manner. But, you know, when it's when you're talking in one county 100,000 head, or I mean, I've got family friends that milk 5,000 head of dairy cattle. I mean, but that's not a family farm. And so when you look at other issues where people are concerned long term about you know, aquifers and water related issues, and they know that twice a year when the lagoons are emptied out and they're, you know, within 6 miles of the plant, they can knife in the secretions from the lagoon for fertilizer. But long term, does this alleviate and protect them from long-term actions if there was damage to the aquifer or any other environmental damages? And does this alleviate that?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, I don't think so. We have never gotten into the discussion of handling the manure waste in terms of this bill, except in the area of smell. And currently in statute, there's a 21-day window when they can spread their manure, and it's going to smell. You know, livestock smell. And to answer your first question, what other industries have this? Since 1982, small operations have had this protection in Minnesota. In 1982, that's what, 30-some years ago or whatever, the livestock was different. And as you mentioned, Representative, livestock has changed. Operations have gotten bigger. And I would suggest that the larger operations are the ones that have, you know, staff on hand to do the EAWs, any NPDES permitting that has to be done. For the most part, they have the ability to do things right and, for the most part, do a good job because they have the size and scope to be able to do that. So with the changing climate and agriculture, we feel that adding this provision to larger operations is something that we should do here, that I feel we should do in Minnesota.
Representative Schoen.
Would Mr. Carlson come down for a quick question? I'm curious, I just want to hear for sure that anything in this particular potential legislation doesn't change any other area of statute for liability or otherwise, and that it is, in your opinion, strictly about air quality and odor, and that's
Carlson.
It.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to give a qualified answer to that, Representative Schoen, because we don't know what is the meaning of measurable adverse effects. So they're never a nuisance on anything if you don't have a measurable adverse effect, and that's not defined. I'll say our most significant problem with the bill is related to odors and runoff that are nuisance conditions but maybe don't have long-term environmental impacts. But we don't know what that term means, and so I'm going to give you a qualified answer. I can't say definitively it only relates to odor, because I just don't know what that standard means. And when you look at the bill on, I'm looking for it right now, I think it's 2.27. It cannot be a nuisance if it has no measurable adverse impact related to the alleged nuisance. I don't know what that term means, and so I can't give you a definitive answer.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I guess I'm thinking about the concept of nuisance. It's a couple hundred years old in our legal system, right? And it's an embodiment of the, I'm thinking about the principle with these farms and then the nearby homeowners, the basic principle that, you know, your right to swing your fist stops when you hit my nose. And it feels like this is a real threat to private property rights. It feels like you've got two different groups here. and the right of the farm, this agricultural operation, to do its activities, that right needs to be limited in some way when that fist hits the homeowner in the nose, so to speak. And so it seems like, why would we take away this legal principle we've had for a couple hundred years for these operations and favor the property rights of the Goliath over the private property rights of the David, the homeowner who's living nearby?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, quickly, again, I would say that those things should be addressed up front in the permitting process. And again, if we have a subjective or objective standard, how do you measure it? Is it just the smell test, which may be different for me or for you? There's just a need to get some certainty into what would actually be a nuisance.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just point out, we've got like 400 years of jurisprudence, you know, that is built up for that, that says that there are certain things that for homeowners, we got a whole system built up to do that. So I don't know why we would favor the rights of the one group over the other based on state standards that I gather. I've been looking all over this, really are not designed for this particular situation. It's designed for some purposes, but at some point, you know, traditionally in our legal system, homeowners and others have a right to enforce their private property rights through this system. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We are running out of time. We have a couple bills left, both of which have out-of-state testifiers. And so what I'd like to do is renew my motion to pass or re-recommend House File 582 as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All those
Madam
in favor,
Chair,
please.
Madam Chair, I ask for roll call.
The roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Applebaum.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Representative Lush.
Nay.
Representative Lohmer.
Aye.
Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Schoen. Representative Vogel.
Aye.
Representative Zeros. Six to four, the motion passes.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. You're on your way to Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Sanders, we're going to hear your bill first. If you could have your out-of-town testifier come first, that would be very helpful. I would like to move House File 864, that it be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Go ahead, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this important bill. House File 864 is an anti-insurance fraud bill, specifically dealing with insurance fraud. I don't know if you know this or not, but Minnesota actually ranks in the top five for auto insurance fraud. And a lot of that has to do with our no-fault system, which is a great system, very consumer-oriented, but also opens the door for a lot of fraud. There are three major sections to this bill, all of which have been implemented in other states and are working successfully in those states to curb fraud. This is not a bill that will eliminate fraud in Minnesota, but it will give us the tools to hopefully slow down fraud and to protect our consumers. I have a couple guests, a couple testifiers with me today, and I'd like to start by turning it over to them and let them proceed, Madam Chair.
Representative Sanders, before we get started, do you have an A3, or is that somebody else's?
Madam Chair, that is my amendment, and if it's okay, I'd like to have my testifier go first, and we'll explain the amendment, because it is kind of a compromise situation, so I think it would unfold
sure.
a little easier for the
committee. Very good.
Is that good?
Go ahead. Thank you for being here. Go ahead and state
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tim Lynch. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs at the Des Plaines, Illinois/Chicago-based National Insurance Crime Bureau. The NICB is a national not-for-profit organization that works with our member companies and law enforcement to investigate major cases of insurance fraud, namely organized crime. We are active in all 50 states, and we employ two agents right here in Minnesota. In short, we strongly support this measure. The enactment of these anti-fraud remedies, along with the effective work of law enforcement, will have a positive impact on the anti-fraud environment of Minnesota and cut back on insurance fraud. From the NICB standpoint, we are the questionable claim repository for about 95% of the property casualty industry. So as we know, insurance companies file claims. Certain amount of those claims are deemed questionable, which means they are suspicious. They might be insurance fraud. And we are seeing some major problems here in Minnesota with respect to medical fraud schemes. What does that mean? Specifically, we are seeing the involvement of staged automobile accidents and collusion among healthcare providers, attorneys, and runners hired to funnel unsuspecting claimants, which leads to a conveyor belt of abuse in the medical payment schemes. Now, I'll put a disclaimer next to the word medical providers and attorneys. 99% of those folks here in Minnesota are good, hardworking citizens. We are talking about a small percentage of folks committing fraud. But in the words of Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo, insurance fraud is, in short, bad people doing bad things to good people. And we are seeing some victimization here of elderly populations, immigrants, and others. In addition, insurance fraud is low risk for a high reward. In fact, the Department of Commerce reported to the Senate Commerce Committee last fall that the economic impact of fraud cases prosecuted in 2014 is north of $55 million. There's four reasons this bill is very important to the NICB. Number one, the rise in those medical fraud schemes that I talked about here ranks, as Tim said, in the top five nationally. And the upticks that we're seeing in lines of those frauds have doubled and tripled over the past couple of years. Number two, and this is very problematic, as states such as Florida and New York have made some anti-fraud crackdowns, we are seeing migration to Minnesota from fraudsters that once operated in those states, and still do, but see this as a good state to do business. Thirdly, these are organized criminals. This is their job. This is their profession. And they do not discriminate. They rip off anyone and everyone. And per that, estimates have this crime costing Minnesota taxpayers north of $1,000 annually. Again, as Tim Sanders mentioned, many of these provisions, in fact, all these provisions, have been enacted in other states, namely California, Florida, Maryland, Michigan, New York, and Texas. And just last week, Kentucky also enacted a bill very similar to this. Our national nexus tells us these are needed anti-fraud remedies. They're not revolutionary. And your state has been statutory obligated to fight fraud. And you have a terrific fraud unit here. But to do it effectively, they need the right tools in the toolbox. And we see these as needed and vital tools. This bill is also supported by a group called the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. That group is comprised of not only insurance companies, but about every major consumer protection organization in this country. They are also a strong supporter of this bill. I want to make that known for the record. With that, I thank you for your time. I thank Representative Sanders for his leadership on this issue. I thank you, Madam Chairman, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Representative Sanders, did you want to go over the amendment, or were you wanting the testifier to do that?
I'll have Mr. Franzen help us go through the
amendment. Very good. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney for NICB, the National Insurance Crime Bureau. And this amendment, the A3, is a result of the hearings we had in Commerce and some of the comments that were made there, and I believe this resolves those issues. This amendment has been vetted both with the Minnesota Association for Justice and the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. There's no objection to it. It's technical. Essentially, what it does is it articulates the hearing process. If a civil penalty is imposed on someone accused of fraud and they want to contest that that allegation, they have Chapter 14 rights. Those rights are specified and articulated in detail here. That would be lines 1.5 through 1.4 of the amendment. We also deleted the language that's currently on the bill 1.12, deleting the Commerce Fraud Bureau as redundant and confusing. And finally, on section 3, there was a provision restricting accident solicitation, where in Commerce it was a gross misdemeanor. The language that it be a gross misdemeanor has been removed. There is no specified penalty. Accordingly, it would be treated under the law as a petty misdemeanor, which we thought was probably a more appropriate provision for that solicitation. Those are the provisions of the amendment, and at any point, Madam Chair, if you'd like me to put them in the context of the bill, I could do that, or do I want to copy the amendment?
Thank you for your testimony. Any discussion on the A3 amendment? I would like to move the A3 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The A3 is adopted. Representative Sanders, I believe you have other testifiers on behalf of the bill.
Madam Chair, we do not have any more testifiers.
Thank you. Then we'll move on with former Representative Jim Abler is here to testify.
Madam Chair, before we move on,
I
have to explain why we have no other testifiers. I think I did before that this is, we've been striving for consensus. We have reached agreements on this legislation with the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. Mr. Goodnow is here. We are working with the Minnesota Association for Justice. We're not quite there yet, but we're moving in that direction. Mr. Johnson has waived his right to testify in the interest of time of the Insurance Federation, but he did want me to mention a letter from Ramsey County, John Choi, endorsing this bill, and particularly the provisions relating to the civil penalties imposed by Commerce and the deauthorization. By and large, there is a general agreement on those two. I believe Mr. Abler's client, Mr. Dahl, a chiropractor, does not like one provision. Otherwise, there's general agreement on those two pieces, and I think both Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Carlson are here available.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. And just so you know, we did not get a letter from Mr. Choi. So if you have that.
Madam Chair, I will submit it.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Mr. Abler.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Abler representing SUMA MRI and here in my own right as well. I've been involved in a lot of this anti-fraud, no-fault work my entire career here and in my 36 years of practice, and also on behalf of my client. This is a hard topic to deal with, and it's always at the end of the hearings, and it's to do it well, to get a bill to pass, is not as easy as bringing forward an idea that we all agree with and it's just passing it. There is universal agreement that we don't want people coming from out of state to stage accidents and commit $55 million of the fraud. Nobody argues about that. The issue comes about, how about the innocent people that get caught up in the net just by accident or from a petty infraction, or that fall in the afoul of some investigator at the Department of Commerce? Those are the people I heard about when I was a legislator, that they couldn't get out of the net. So some assertion was brought, and they could never get done. Bail bondsmen, agents, other kinds of people who run afoul of that. The amendment that went on actually took out reference to the Department of Fraud. I came to talk about that with some concerns. Now the bill is silent on who would do the investigation, and the commissioner now may issue an order upon finding intent of fraud. It doesn't say who can do it. So you've actually removed the safeguard, just to caution you. And the second concern I have is about the standard of evidence. It's curious, a chiropractor comes forward talking about evidentiary standards, but actually if you do this long enough, you realize how important those are. The standard in the bill is preponderance, which means they probably did it. That's 51%. And I can't tell how many times as a married man I've needed that 49% to explain the rest of why it's not what you thought. The standard I recommend to you that's more safe is clear and convincing, which is 75%. That means we're quite sure they did it. That you can't go to beyond a reasonable doubt that's a conviction, and the bill, it makes it unworkable. But there are people who have been part of investigations and so on that would have been caught up in that intermediate part between preponderance and clear and convincing. And I don't know, I've been trying to work with the organizations on this, and they're disinterested, Madam Chair. They think this is a good standard because they want to start cracking down on fraud. And we're all against fraud. But in the same way, you don't have any innocent people getting caught up in this. That's the responsibility of this committee. And so I urge you to think about this. I'm going to continue to work. But I'll tell you, having done all this no-fault work, what happens in these bills is those people that got the votes hunker down and they enjoy the fact they got their votes. Real no-fault reform was evidenced in 2012 when I had the task force, which was the first successful task force that actually had a collegial collaborative approach where people truly came on board and we got some stuff done. If we move away from where the people are truly interacting, and there's been some interaction, not to minimize that, you're going to wind up with a bill that may not even get signed. And so you want to really crack down on the fraud, and you want to push the people to behave. But there's fraud on a whole bunch of different parts, Madam Chair and members. There's bad actions by a few insurance companies or a few adjusters who go crazy. There's some agents who are wrong. There's some providers who are wrong. But the most of the people are really, really good. And you don't want to draw them up into the net where they could be caught. So those are my concerns. And if they could address that, I would be very happy to be a fan of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Abler. Representative Sanders, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say, I mean, we think it's a good bill. A lot of support, a lot of movement on this bill to reach agreement. We have support from the Ramsey County attorneys, Washington County, Dakota County, Anoka County attorneys, and would appreciate all the members' support.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. And my apologies to Mr. Carlson. He'd given me his name, and it was written on the side here, so my apologies. Go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. And I'll be very brief because I recognize your time frame here. I want to make a record on the A3 amendment. I've talked with Mr. Franzen about this, and I want to confirm this on the record, that the allegations from the insurance commissioner that they may make against a provider who they do not license, we're talking about doctors and chiropractors that are licensed by some other board. I don't want to get into a situation where they're making an allegation that becomes public that may be unfounded. Mr. Franzen informs me that under the Data Practices Act that those allegations are private until there is a final order, and I want to confirm that on the record. As to the bill itself, Madam Chair and members, we obviously are opposed to fraud in any of its form, whether it's from an insurance company, an attorney, a staged accident. We think the bill has some problems as it relates to people being able to get their needed information about their legal rights, but we've been willing to work with the industry to advance this bill. We wouldn't ask you to vote no on it today. However, if it was a final package, I would maybe have a different response. It's a work in progress, and we wouldn't ask you to hold it here.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I understand now I've been told that this will not be going to transportation, it will be going to public safety. So with that, I would renew my motion that House File 864 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Sanders. We are in recess. When we return tonight, we will hear Representative Whalen's bill and pick up our agenda there. Thank you, folks. The Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. The first order of business is the House File 864, and I move to reconsider the passage of 864. We're going to redo this because it was supposed to be going to the General Register, and I was going to be sending it to Public Safety, but the A3 amendment that we adopted on it took out the language that would require it to go to Public Safety.
Yeah.
So, all those in favor?
If you can clarify, 864.
The Sanders bill?
Yes, the Sanders bill.
Insurance fraud.
Okay, we're good.
We're good, then.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. All those in favor of reconsideration of the passage of House File 864 to have it re-referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. That is on its way to the General Register. Oh. What? So I did it in the wrong order? Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, it is.
Oh.
So we refer to send it back to
the That's a motion now.
Motion.
That's a separate motion. Okay, so I didn't do the separate motion. I did it all at once. Yeah, I'm trying to save time. Okay, members, I move to reconsider passage of House File 864. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, now, all those in favor of passage of House File 864, have we referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's on its way. House File 161, Representative Zerwas. And if I could ask House staff just to address what portion of House File 161 applies to our committee, that would be fantastic.
Chair and representatives, I believe this bill was referred to the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee because there are aspects of it that deal with data on the ABLE accounts. There's a number of provisions throughout the bill that address the data. Section 1 has a reference to the data, and then later in the bill it goes into more detail about how the data is classified. Section 6 has a lot of the substantive provisions related to that, including subdivision 8, which is the data related to those accounts. So I believe that's the...
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Representative Zerwas, to your bill and those areas, if you could focus on the areas that apply to this committee, that would be preferable and appreciated.
All right, Madam Chair and members, I will move House File 161 to be in front of the committee. And to the bill, Madam Chair, this is enacting language for a federal provision passed and signed into law by the United States Congress, allowing for savings account saving plans similar to a 529 saving college saving plans, but for individuals with lifelong disabilities. It doesn't have a non-taxable income portion for contributing to the account, but what it does do is allows a family to contribute into this account as a child, as a disabled child grows up, and then once they are an adult and need housing or supportive services or educational services, it's my understanding that this accrued income in this account won't count as an asset and disqualify them from other SSI benefits as such. And so it's, I believe the data as covered in the bill, the information and participants, it's private data, it's not public.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Any member questions? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against House File 161? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas renews his motion. That House File 161 be re-referred to the Committee on GovOps. And with that, members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Not quite on your way. Do you want the next one or no?
Oh, sure. Are you the next one on the agenda? Yes. House File 7092.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 792 to be in front of the House Bill 792 was brought to me by a constituent of mine that deals with adult children of deceased parents and accessing medical records. And so I have a constituent, and there are people that, as they grow up, they're experiencing medical conditions or or symptoms. In this instance, it was similar to what a deceased parent had previously experienced. They tried to get access to the medical records to look at a potential of a genetic disease or diagnosis. And as of right now, there is a lot of exceptions for getting into a someone else's medical records after they passed away. A surviving spouse would have access. The parents of a deceased patient would have access. A person the patient appoints in writing as a representative would have access. And this would be a three word change. We would be adding surviving adult children.
Discussion on House File 792. Seeing none, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 792 be referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Bill is adopted. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Next on the agenda, House File 995. Representative Rarick, where are our treats?
I thought that was
pretty
first.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, Madam Chair, have we killed the billy yet this year?
No, we have not. Well, welcome to the committee anyway, Representative Rarick.
I asked if I should bring Irish whiskey, but I was told I shouldn't do that.
Probably not do that.
Ask me next time.
Don't ask on the record.
Yeah. All right. Representative Rarick, I will move House File 995. Looks like it would need to be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee. Is that right? All right. Go ahead with your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 995 is a bill to help counties. Currently, under the Indian Tribe Welfare Act, there's an agreement that tribal courts are in charge of out-of-home placement cases for tribes. Under that act, the federal government pays some of the costs involved. The remainder of the costs are put upon the counties. And because some counties have such higher populations, it's kind of an unfair cost to certain counties in the state. So what this bill is asking is that instead of the counties being obligated with this payment, that the state would take that on. I guess as far as this committee is concerned, there is data from each individual case that has to be exchanged for the state in order for the Department of Revenue to write the check to the county. That data is already being exchanged, and so there is not shouldn't be anything new to this, and there's already agreements in place, so that is being dealt with, and no personal information is available to the public through that process.
Is there any questions or comments? Or is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on House File 995? Seeing none, the public testimony portion will close. Any additional discussion on this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Rarick refers his motion. Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 995 re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division Committee.
Okay.
I move for House File 995 to be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division Committee. Third time's the charm. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed say nay. Motion carries. Okay, next up is House File 722. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I move that House File 722 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. Representative Neuberger, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. House File 722 is a bill that's called the Emergency Powers. It's called the Emergency Powers Bill. Just days after Hurricane Katrina hit, at the time, the New Orleans Police Superintendent, Eddie Compass, issued an order to confiscate all firearms, including those from law-abiding residents. He said, quote, no one will be able to be armed, end quote. He also said that, quote, guns will be taken, only law enforcement will be allowed to have guns, end quote. Deputy Police Chief Warren Riley told the Associated Press, quote, that we're going to take all of the weapons, end quote. Law enforcement and National Guard troops were sent door to door, as we saw on television, in Katrina, right after Katrina in New Orleans, to take firearms from law-abiding hurricane survivors who were just trying to protect themselves from looters and thugs who, at the time, as we all know, were going wild on the streets. We also saw some similar situations. They weren't confiscating firearms, but there was a necessary, they were needed by the citizens right after the LA riots of 1992. We saw that the Korean community was very concerned about the welfare of their businesses, and they set up their own personal guard units on the roofs of their businesses. They were armed, lawfully armed, and their businesses were not burned to the ground and looted like the rest of the businesses in the community were. Hurricane Katrina and the LA riots showed us what can happen when emergencies either natural or man-made strike. There are things that we can count on when these occur. A complete breakdown of law and order, no 911 service, an overtaxed police department that's unable to respond to calls for help, and people will be left to their own devices to protect themselves and their families and their property. We have seen one reflection of this when we had the I-35 bridge collapse. At the time I was working that day, and the cell system was completely overwhelmed in the area. You couldn't get a cell phone call out. So our main means of communication broke down immediately within that area. So thankfully we didn't have any civil breakdown, but our communication system in that area did break down. The chaos and the civil disorder we witnessed in New Orleans after the city abolished the rights of law-abiding Americans to defend themselves with firearms against out-of-control criminals confirmed gun owners' worst fears that the government gun confiscations can happen in America. When 911 is non-existent and law enforcement personnel are overwhelmed with search and rescue missions and other emergency duties, law-abiding Americans must have an effective means to protect themselves and their families. The Emergency Powers Bill prohibits the state and local governments from confiscating legal firearms from law-abiding citizens during natural disasters. Once again, I want to repeat that because that is the absolute foundation of this bill. The Emergency Powers Bill prohibits the state and local governments from confiscating legal firearms from law-abiding citizens during natural disasters. A majority of states and the federal government have now passed such protective bills. So I believe there's 32 states now that have done this because of overwhelming bipartisan support and an outcry for protection from the people. Just as a matter of course as well, within 2 months after after New Orleans was put back together, New Orleans state legislature passed this law as well, the same law. That was one of the first places that went through. This 722 does have the support. I think Gilchrist supports it. I'll get back to you on that. No, they do. They support this, as you know. The NRA has also supports this. They have sent out a letter of endorsement and support for this. It should be in your email file. I did have a multimedia presentation. Given our restricted means, I was going to ask if Representative Lesh and Representative Grunhagen would do a reenactment for us, but I'll defer to their judgment. In this case,
Representative Neuberger,
yes.
If we could just get to lines 2.28,
yes,
2.29, that's why your bill is here?
Absolutely.
And, yeah, if you could have just addressed that, then we can take our vote.
Okay. 2.28 and 2.29 refer to what would happen if you had a grievance. The language is real simple. In an action or proceeding to enforce this section, the court must award the prevailing plaintiff reasonable court costs and expenses, including attorney fees. So if your firearms are confiscated during a proclaimed state of emergency, if they're confiscated and they are not returned to you, and you file a case in the local courts, filing your grievance, the winning plaintiff, this is what it would apply to, the winning plaintiff.
Thank you. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Member questions. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really been tracking this that closely either. And I read in my DFL brief that there was a question asked in the last committee that I had the same question, but I didn't see an answer here, that if cops aren't going to abide by the Second Amendment, why would they abide by House File 722?
Representative Neuberger.
Well, Representative Lesh, that's an excellent question, and that goes right to the very essence of human nature. We have laws. That's what we do. We make laws here at the legislature. It is up to the individual citizens to whether or not they choose to abide by it or not. I would hope that the law enforcement community would be professional enough to respect our Second Amendment rights in this matter.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Because, of course, it's not just with guns. It's any property. I mean, they can't be... You can't just go to someone's door and say, well, I'm going to take your record player either. So I'm curious as to how, if they ignore that.
What's a record?
Yeah.
Don't you watch rap videos? Thank you. I appreciate it, Zero. So I guess... That's my question related to that. And, you know, maybe in the other states, maybe it is belt and suspenders, I don't know, but when civil disorder breaks down, you know, kind of it's open season, really, pardon the pun. But is there anything in your bill that would compel an immediate hearing? Okay, because, you know, if they go around and do this, and people are like, what's going on? What are the cops doing? And they can say, okay, we'll give you a hearing in a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story there?
Representative Neuberger.
Madam Chair, I do have someone that could answer this question better than I could, a professor here.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor emeritus at Hamline University in their law school. I'm not here on their behalf today. I'm chairman of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I'm here on their behalf. Essentially, in answer to both of your questions, what the statute does is implement in much more specific terminology the language that is otherwise in the Second Amendment. So the open questions are answered here. Secondly, if you look on line 2.24 to 2.27, there is a procedure for going into court and having immediate return of your property.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all the questions I have.
Other member questions? Seeing none, where are we? House File 722 is referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. No. All those in favor of referring House File 722 to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. You're on your way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
If I may, and if Mr. Danielson could come in. Madam Chair, it being in honor of St. Patrick, who drove the snakes out of Ireland with the aid, I believe, of firearms, I have for us
Shamrock Shakes on St. Patrick's Day. So this has been a pseudo-tradition in civil law committee that we've had, and I hope members enjoy.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Nobody loves free stuff more than legislators.
Thank you, Representative Lawson.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Up next, House File 1828. Representative Bush, that's you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Flash.
I move House File 1828 that it be re-referred to
the Committee on Taxes.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right.
So, Madam Chair, House File 1828 is a very important piece of legislation. It's my re-election bill. And this
is one
bill, because if you have to, in order to deal with property taxes, if you have to submit your personal taxes to revenue in order to determine your property taxes, for example, with the circuit breaker or something, law designates that your income tax data is private, okay? And that's because it is assessed by a local unit of government, your property taxes are. Well, if you're assessed by the state for your property taxes, then there is no designation, there is no like designation. And there has been concerns by certain industries whose property taxes are assessed by the state, for example, pipelines or utilities or railroads, that their data could be made public, and so there have been issues with that. So we've got a fix-it bill clarifying that it is, in fact, fixed, that it's private, hence the three words, and the state. You've got an issue. Okay? So I have with me someone who knows a lot more about this, Mr. Cummings, if he wants to speak on it. Unless you don't need to hear from him, because I think it's pretty easy, but maybe you can just stand for
questions. Well, he made the trip.
He did make
He needs to get his...
He is getting paid for... He gets paid by the word, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cummings, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you to Representative Lesh and for you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill. I think Representative Lesh did a very good job at outlining the contours of what this is trying to do. As we... most of the property tax assessment in the state is delegated to the counties for valuation purposes, but there are some complex forms of property that are centrally assessed at the state. So when you look at the statute, sometimes there is more information that is needed in order to value a property, and once that goes into the property tax system, it is a public tax. And sometimes people are giving that information over with the expectation that that would remain private. Maybe it's future income calculations or other types of things that they would like to remain private. So in terms of valuation, we think that as it is done at the locals, that at the state, that that should remain private too. And as we looked at it, said political subdivisions, and because not all assessments are done by political subdivisions, some is done at the state, deemed appropriate to add those three words. Wonderful. I'll stand for questions, and thank you again, Madam Chair.
Wonderful, thank you. Is there a John Van Nerden here that plans to testify? Were you planning to testify, sir?
If I need to.
Okay.
Just here for questions.
Just here for questions. All right. Members, any questions? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify in favor or having concerns with this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 1828 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to taxes. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Oh,
from his mother.
They got
me
quite a bit.
Let's go get Sarah. Well, let's see. Members, I think we will, thank you. We may take a 10-minute recess. We're waiting for a testifier to get here on the next bill. So we will be in recess for about 10 minutes. We will reconvene the committee on civil law and data practices. Thank you for indulging us with that brief respite. And again, thank you, Representative Lesh, for those delicious shamrock shakes that were lovely. Okay, we're on to House File. Oh, 1047. Representative Whalen is here, and Representative Whalen, I will move House File 1047, and it would be going to be referred to the General Register. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Can you all hear me okay? I can't.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Yeah, we can. It's a small enough room.
Okay. So while I've already presented my first bill, I did hear there's a tradition in this specific committee that the first time I present a bill here, I should bring treats. So I do have cookies for you all, and since I'm also a little Irish, they're green in honor of St. Patrick's Day.
Well, thank you.
So not as good as the shakes, but... so I don't know if there's anyone who can...
Oh, here come the pages
those.
Now.
But
and the pages, be sure and help yourself.
Yes, and there should be enough at least for everyone to have two, but since it's your birthday, Representative, please have three.
Well, thank you, Representative Whalen.
Yes.
And just so you know, it isn't just a rule for this committee. It's a new amended House rule.
Oh, is it? Okay. Good to know. I will keep that in mind.
Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you. So while we'll be focusing today on the portion of the bill that obviously refers to civil penalties, to begin, I would like to just briefly share why I decided to carry this bill. As I was campaigning, I actually came across a book called An Accidental Life, and it is a fiction story, but it's based on true events. The more I read, the more shocked I became, and then at the end of the book, the author details the true events that she based the story on. Many of you may know the story of Jill Stanek. She's a nurse at Christ Hospital in Illinois, and in 2001, she provided testimony to Congress that inspired the book, telling really a harrowing tale of finding an infant who had survived an abortion, alive in a utility room, but left to die because the parents did not want to hold him, and the nurse who had assisted in the abortion did not have time to rock him or provide what is termed comfort care. So, Nurse Stanek, after finding the child, rocked him for 45 minutes while he struggled to breathe before he eventually died. I couldn't believe, and I still struggle to believe, that this happened in the United States when we have the technology to help these babies. And there are cases where infants have survived abortions to live full lives. So, briefly, background on federal and state law. Right now, infants born alive as a result of failed abortions are recognized as a person, but the law does little else. There's no clear consequence for physicians who fail to provide care to these infants, and the crime continues nationwide despite the Born Alive Infant Protection Act passed by Congress more than a decade ago. So this bill seeks to address that issue in Minnesota and includes civil remedies for physicians who fail to provide care to infants who are born alive as the result of a failed abortion. Specifically, if an infant is born alive after an abortion and is subsequently injured or dies as a result of the physician's failure to provide care, then this bill would allow for an action to be brought against that physician. And in this situation, the physician may also be subject to revocation of their license. If judgment is rendered against them, there would be automatic suspension of their license for at least a year. The bill also includes a provision that allows the court to render judgment for reasonable attorney's fees in favor of the plaintiff against the defendant if judgment is rendered in favor of the plaintiff, or conversely for the defendant against the plaintiff if judgment is rendered in favor of the defendant. The bill also allows the courts to determine whether or not anonymity of the woman upon whom the abortion was performed shall be preserved. And finally, the bill outlines that should an infant survive, the parents have 30 days to accept parental rights, otherwise the child would become a ward of the state. And at this time, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Andrew Rao from NCCL to provide brief testimony, and I'm also willing to stand for questions.
Thank you. Ms. Rao, thank you for being here this evening, and thank your daughter for
making the trek with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
I'm going to pull the microphone up. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Whalen, as well for bringing this bill forward. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am the Legislative Director with MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. And I think Representative Whalen has done a good job of summarizing the bill, and I know you guys have lots on your agenda, so I will be very brief, but happy to answer questions as well. I do want to point out just a couple of things. One is that there are very few abortions in Minnesota that are late enough in a pregnancy where the unborn child is likely to be viable. But there are a few that happen each year. And so this law and this legislation is good. But even for those that aren't viable, this is still important, and you know, when those babies are so tiny that they aren't able to survive, Minnesota's law and this legislation does require that comfort care be provided, which, as Representative Whalen had discussed as well, could include simply holding or rocking the baby, even placing the baby in an appropriate location and covering it with a blanket. Another provision that I wanted to point out to members of the committee can be found on lines 3.22 to 3.24 and states specifically that really this legislation has nothing to do with whether or not one has an individual has a right to abortion. Specifically, it states nothing in this section shall be construed to affirm, deny, expand, or contract any legal status or legal right applicable to any member of the species Homo sapiens at any point prior to being born alive as defined in this section. And also, you know, just a reminder that this legislation is very closely mirrors federal legislation, or federal law, I should say, which passed back in 2002. At the time that it passed as a voice vote in the House of Representatives and with unanimous consent in the Senate. And we hope that this legislation can enjoy as broad support today as it did in Congress. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Member questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this really is a statement rather than necessarily a question. You know, I've read this bill, and clearly, based on the sections in the bill, it really should be going to public safety, as they have the courts within their jurisdiction. There also talks about criminal and civil liabilities that are in this bill. And I understand that the chair of that committee said he didn't want to hear it. But just because you don't want to hear a bill doesn't mean that you shouldn't hear a bill. Clearly, this bill falls clearly within the jurisdiction of that committee. I just texted him and said, clearly, he should have heard this bill. So, Madam Chair, I thought all of the speeches at the beginning of session was about honoring the process. And I would just ask that this committee should honor the process of the legislature and actually send a bill to the committee that it rightfully belongs going to.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Any other comments or questions for the testifiers? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or show concerns with this bill? All those in favor of House File 1047 being re-referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
The bill is adopted and ready to go to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Whalen, and Ms. Rao.
Thank you.
And the CA just went to get Representative Anderson, who will be hearing her bill. House File 1467. Is there anyone planning to sit at the testifier's table with Representative Anderson? Anybody already? Okay. I'm sure she'll be up here shortly.
Madam Chair, may I place some visuals in front of the table?
You may.
Mm-hmm.
They're in commerce and they're having like this. Over there. No, I asked them to tell them no. What does that mean when they're like, okay. I don't know, maybe. They're on group. And they're just talking.
She's on her way.
I was willing, Madam Chair, to start, but if she's on her way, that's still.
Right. She's coming from the basement, so.
She's on this floor just getting her files.
Okay, right. She's coming from the basement, so.
She's on this floor just getting her files.
Okay.
And
very good. Thank you for the
opportunity. I'm one of the co-authors, but the chief author is coming as better.
Okay. She's better looking than you, too.
Thank you.
No problem.
We could interview our honorary member tonight, Alice, down there. We could ask her all about what's going on in the 8th grade.
Speaking of the
she exercises it right.
Remain silent.
Yeah. Lawyer may or may not be on her side in specific.
Welcome, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I can put my screen.
Members, I'll be brief because I know it's late and we've all had long days with the committee deadlines and whatnot. All my bill does is it allows...
Representative Anderson, I'll move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would like to move House File 1467 to be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Madam Chair, right now, Hennepin County has purchased a plot of land, and what they're looking to do is have... have the consideration of public safety be part of the process for any potential railroad development along this corridor. And so what this bill does is it says that the railroad will not be able to use their traditional condemnation powers to take that land if there is a public safety concern at issue. I have with me today Commissioner Jeff Johnson from Hennepin County that is here to answer any questions that you have and give just a little brief testimony for you as well.
Okay, go ahead. Instructions for me?
As a hint, I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to talk as fast as I can.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here actually representing the Hennepin County Board today. We voted...
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry, Jeff Johnson. I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner. I represent western and northwestern Hennepin County. And I'm representing the County Board. We voted unanimously a few weeks ago to support this bill. Just as an update, we voted just this afternoon to unanimously to finalize the purchase of the piece of land that Representative Anderson mentioned. And we did that in an effort, first of all, to prevent this connection, but more importantly, to protect public safety in Hennepin County. And to be honest, the vote to purchase that piece of land did not come naturally to me. I'm loathe to have government purchasing land, and I'm usually fighting on the other side of that issue. But this is a rather extraordinary situation in Hennepin County right now. There are some very serious public safety concerns that we have about this connection. We are likely to see greatly increased traffic throughout that line, all the way out to my district and Sarah's district in Plymouth. We're going to see very long trains, we're going to see slower trains, and we're going to see, most importantly, those trains blocking multiple at-grade crossings at the same time, which is going to cause some serious problems, public safety problems, for first responders, for fire, for police, for the North Memorial Ambulance Service. And we are just trying in Hennepin County to address these issues, I think, in a reasonable way. We have given, as a state, tremendous eminent domain powers to railroads. All this bill does is it clarifies that there is a limit to those powers, and it's a very narrowly tailored limit at that. So let me just say, to wrap it up, here's how I look at the bill. When you have a dispute over the use of that tremendous power to take people's properties to eminent domain, what this bill does is it gives an edge in that dispute to local officials who have to run for election over those who don't. That's all it does, and I think that is eminently reasonable. So on behalf of the County Board, I'd ask for your support, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Are there any committee representative questions, any member questions? Wow. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson, welcome back.
Thank you.
So why just Hennepin County?
Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. You know, from a policy standpoint, if this were statewide, I think we'd all be happy with that, but I think the intent was to tailor this as narrowly as possible, and I don't know if Representative Anderson has a different answer to that. But.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesh. This is more of responding to an immediate situation and trying to get the best solution out the door as fast as possible. I think that it does beg the question of, we need to have a conversation of more of a statewide policy, and I'd be happy to get your thoughts on that and work with you on that in the future as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. In my opinion, I understand the perspective. So trying to get it out the door, it's a lot easier if you don't implicate interests of other parts of the state and bog it down with that. I get that, but I think of our situation in St. Paul, for example, the Como Crossing, which, you know, my neighbors are talking about hazardous issues there as well, public safety. And when we talk about remediating those safety concerns, the railroad's got themselves a cap of 10% that they have to contribute to that. And, I think that needs to be a conversation as well. Clearly, the people agreed with that at some point. It made sense to them, but I think this begs a broader conversation, and I expect if you guys get this that there will be conversations among other counties in the future, and that's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Any other, Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, I understand the public safety issue. In my district, we have the only rail going up to Duluth. And we've actually clocked and timed the trains how long they've blocked a state highway. 67 minutes. The issues you're talking about, they're not just happening here. They're happening everywhere. The rail lines are at maximum capacity. And it might be an issue in this area, but by doing this, is this going to relieve issues in other areas? That's the question. By putting in this junction, is it going to relieve issues in other areas of your county that you have problems in? I think that I understand, and the intimate domain issue needs to be, I feel, needs a major overhaul. And I think it's going to be a huge conversation on that, because it's a few years ago we had an issue where a city actually removed a business to give a business to somebody else. So I think we really need to look at the whole intimate domain issue. But also with this program, we got to make sure that if we do this to stop, as a way to stop the train from doing this in this area, is that going to create problems elsewhere?
Representative Anderson?
So we have to look at it. Look at everything in full capacity.
Representative Anderson, do you want to address, was that a question, Representative Johnson, or just a comment?
Sort of a comment. If they have me answer anything, I would appreciate it.
Okay. Any comments? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. In looking at this issue, this can happen to anywhere. You're right. This is a problem that is not unique to Hennepin County. And as I mentioned to Representative Lesh, this does beg the question of having a larger conversation overall and what this means. We do have maps in front of you here, too, that will show you what exactly the proposal does. Basically, what it does is it relieves congestion in the Minneapolis area and then pushes that out into the Plymouth and those communities. So that's where the congestion is being relieved, and it's then pushing it out to Plymouth, Golden Valley, Robbinsdale, Crystal, and those communities. So that's where you're seeing the push, and we're trying to solve that with this piece of legislation here. But like I said to Representative Lesh, I'd be happy to work with you on a broader scale level of what does this mean for our state as a whole.
I have a question, and this might go to Commissioner Johnson. And you know, if Hennepin County purchases this land and the sale goes through, is there going to be tight restrictions placed on what that land could be used for?
Madam Chair, I don't think that's the plan right now. As a matter of fact, the plan right now is that the businesses, there are two businesses on that piece of land, and they are just going to continue operating as they have for decades. There's, I believe, a tire shop and a mechanic on that piece of property.
Okay, at a later date, then, Commissioner Johnson could, I suppose anybody could buy them out, but of course, my concern is with the Bottineau line, proposed Bottineau line being so close to this area, is there any thing that would stop this land purchase from being something that would work in favor of going forward with that train line?
Madam Chair, I don't know, other than my no vote, I'm not sure whether there's anything, any provision in the agreement that would address that. Okay. Yeah, there's nothing in the separate issues, but there's nothing in the agreement.
There's nothing in the agreement that would either prohibit it or allow it.
Correct.
Okay, is that something that could be put in the language? Are you an attorney back there? Are you the attorney?
From the manager, yes. Attorney.
Thank you for being here. If you could state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Rogan. I'm with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. The purchase agreement is a simple, straightforward purchase agreement where we're purchasing the land from the current owners, and there's nothing in the agreement that says anything about the Bottineau line at all. the Botno line, this land abuts the railroad right-of-way, but it really has nothing to do. They're completely independent of one another.
Okay.
And I guess to answer your question, could there be something in there? I don't think there could be anything in there because this land isn't needed at all for the Botno LRT. The LRT, the preferred alternative, is wholly within the BNSF right-of-way, and so this property has nothing to do with the LRT line, the proposed LRT line.
Okay, thank you. Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either for this bill or express concerns with the bill? All right. Oh, we have someone coming forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Sutter. I'm the Acting Community Development Director for the City of Crystal.
Thank you for being here. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I know it's late. I'll try to be brief. I want to briefly describe the two railroad lines that cross in Crystal. The BNSF is a very little-used line that runs roughly north-south. It was dead-ended in the vicinity of Monticello perhaps 30 years ago or something like that. It has had very little traffic since then. And in contrast, the east-west running Canadian Pacific is a very heavily used line with dozens of long freight trains each day. These two lines have never been connected. And Burlington Northern is proposing to build this connection through property currently occupied by private businesses in the city of Crystal to divert some amount. We don't know how much because Canadian Pacific refuses to say anything about this, which is a concern all by itself. But they're proposing to divert some amount of Canadian Pacific traffic off of the CP line onto the little used BNSF line. Mayor Murphy from Robbinsdale will testify after me with concerns specific to that city. But in the case of Crystal, our public safety concerns are focused front and center on law enforcement and fire response to the northern third of our city. One of the maps before you, and I think you might have a handout of it, shows that presently, because the BNSF line is so little used, if a police officer is heading north on Douglas Drive and sees the crossing arms come down, they have an escape route. They can get over to Corvallis Avenue, cross the BNSF line, which again almost never has a train on it, to get to County Road 81, and then they can take the overpass over the Canadian Pacific to the northern third of our city. If the connector is built, a single 1 mile long train will close all five at grade crossings, including our Corvallis Avenue escape route. Those five crossings represent the only way to get over this route between Winnetka Avenue and New Hope and Highway 100 in Robbinsdale, which would lead to either a 2 mile round trip detour to the west or a 3 mile round trip detour to the east. Everyone who lives in a railroad community or grew up in a railroad community knows you find your workaround. You find your way to get around the train, right? This is our workaround, and it would be cut off if the connector is built. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify or have questions for this testifier? Okay. It looks like we have one more testifier. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, Director of Government Affairs for North Memorial Healthcare. We're the large Level 1 Trauma Center in Robbinsdale, about a 566-bed trauma center which services the entire western Hennepin County. We also operate the large ambulance operation, which has about 22 ambulances on during our peak time from lower North Minneapolis all the way up through the Wright County-Hennepin County border. And to keep it short, our concern is as many of these crossings are used to access the hospital, and if these accesses are closed, we also would have a hard time getting down into there with some of these patients that are time-sensitive patients. We also work very closely with Hennepin County on what's called Ordinance 9, where we maintain a very strict response time compliance in Hennepin County, where we try to get to every ambulance call within 90% of the time in 10 minutes or less. And that would jeopardize that quite a bit as we've looked at it of the proposed train route. And I'll just add with this is that many times we can have 22 ambulances available and all of a sudden 19 of them are busy. and we have one or two that cover the entire western Hennepin County, and that vehicle sits at 42nd and 100, which is on this side of that corridor of the train, which would impact how we respond to the other side of it. So open for questions, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Any member questions? Seeing none.
I have a question.
Representative Lesh.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. Are we sure this will work? I mean, has this initiative worked in other states that have faced the same problems? And I ask because, you know, the railroads are nobody to be trifled with. I mean, they've had about a good century of getting special provisions into federal and state law, plus they're loaded to the hilt with departments full of lawyers that could probably fight us on this. I mean, I can foresee a Commerce Clause challenge that challenges that have been sustained on more flimsy grounds than this and tie us up in federal courts. Will it work? Will this law work?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I phoned a friend here, and when we were talking about other states, I'd be helpful to have a question.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative, the short answer to your question is yes, I think this will do it. The eminent domain authority that we're talking about here is something that, as Commissioner Johnson talked about, is actually state law. The state has granted eminent domain authority to the railroads, and in a normal case, eminent domain is the ability for either a public or private property to be taken. And in this situation, where you had two different bodies, both with eminent domain authority, one being the railroad, one being Hennepin County. What a court would do in the first instance, what it would look to see, has the legislature clearly spoken to see who has priority here? And that's what this bill does. This bill will clearly state that the legislature has spoken and has determined that when a railroad tries to condemn public property in Hennepin County, and the Hennepin County Board has made the findings that are required in this bill, that the legislature has spoken and that the priority goes to Hennepin County, and the condemnation cannot proceed. Absent this bill being passed, we would be stuck in a situation where a court would look to see is the condemning authority's proposed use of the property inconsistent with the condemnees, in this case Hennepin County's, use of the property. I think we would take the position that it would be, that the very reason that we purchased the property was to protect public safety. But it becomes a more difficult question to discern what the answer would be. With this bill, it becomes crystal clear that the legislature has spoken and has said that the priority goes to the public body when a railroad is trying to condemn the property, and the findings have been made that are required in this proposed bill.
Representative Lesh.
I'm sure. Thank you. I mean, you know, if I'm a railroad lawyer, I'm not going to proceed. I'm going to proceed on some other theory other than the condemnation piece, because I'm sure the railroad had a lot more friends around here 60 years ago, or whenever we gave them this condemnation authority. But maybe that's not the case now, because it looks like Representative Anderson's bill is winding its way through. So I'm going to proceed on different theories, be they involve federal theories or federal law, or even, as I stated, Commerce Clause. So I guess as a railroad, I'll use the example of St. Paul. Okay, so there are a few railroad bridges over the river in downtown St. Paul. And once in a while, when Public Works or Planning and Economic Development says, you know, you're not using these bridges, we'd really like to either open it up for river traffic or maybe put a bicycle bridge off there, and the city approaches the railroad. Next thing you know, there are trains going across there a couple times a day. They have complete ability to design their structure how they want to. Now, granted, they're driven by profit, not by spite. However, at the same time, it's a pretty big behemoth to fight against. So that's the only reason I asked the question. I wish you the best of luck on this, regardless.
Any other member questions? Anyone else wishing to testify for or against this bill? Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Regan Murphy, Mayor of Robbinsdale. I'll be short and brief. I just want to let the committee know that I fully support this bill. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. And I also am here to say for the mayors of Golden Valley, Plymouth, Crystal, who are also negatively impacted by this proposal, also in full support. Thank you, and if there's any questions, I'll entertain them.
Any member questions?
Thank you for your testimony. Hello there. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I have some maps I'd like to hand out to the committee members.
We have some pages that can help with that.
These will help explain the project, what we're doing, and why. I guess the real question becomes, should one county, any county, have the ability to kill a project that has not only ramifications in that county, but also has effect on the entire region, effect on the entire state, and the economy of the state. As you may know, in the last year, there were some severe service issues on BNSF Railway and also on CP Rail. Grain shipments were backed up. Taconite shipments were backed up. Coal deliveries were delayed. All of this was because of a large increase in traffic, and the railroads lacking the capacity to handle the traffic that was being tendered to it. Last September, a joint hearing was held, five committees of the state legislature, joint hearing on railroad service problems, and it was very loud and clear that this situation was not tolerable, that it was injuring the state, that we were to do something about it. At that time, we said that we were on a large capital program to spend our way out of this to have capacity, including double-tracking projects in the state of Minnesota that would be done this year, and eliminate the bottlenecks that were causing the service issues. The fourth map, titled BNSF and CP Current Routes and Trackage Rights, shows the problem that we have here. One of the single largest bottlenecks on the system is in the Twin Cities area. What happens is CP trains coming from the west currently go through Crystal, and east of Crystal, about half of them go on to a CP yard. The other half go on to BNSF trackage for delivery to another CP yard in St. Paul. When those trains are making that transition on BNSF track, they have to move at speeds of under 10 miles an hour because of the track curvature in that area and the limitations. To what happens when that takes place is both of our main lines are closed down for 20 minutes at a time, about 4 hours a day that our main lines are shut down. We lose the ability right there for about 24 trains a day to move through the system. What we've proposed, we don't even have a completed agreement with CP yet, but what we're proposing is build a 2,000-foot connector in Crystal to divert those roughly 12 trains a day that are based on today's traffic. They would head south on what is called the Monticello subdivision. This used to be a main line on the old Great Northern going up towards St. Cloud. It's been in existence for more than 100 years. Traffic in recent years, yes, has been very light, but it has been a rail line for more than 100 years, and at one time was a secondary main. The question, as I said, is whether or not a single county is able to kill a project that has implications for the entire state's economy. We're talking about the agricultural industry, we're talking about mining, we're talking about the power plants, we're talking about everything that moves through Minnesota. Traffic originating and terminating in Minnesota as well as moving through it. These are trains that are already here. They're already moving through Twin Cities communities. They're already moving over crossings in the Twin Cities. The question is, can we move them more efficiently? What happens when this blockage takes place for 20 minutes at a time is that five of our subdivisions are shut down. They're cut off. As a result, we have prolonged block crossing issues going up our line toward Elk River, St. Cloud. Coon Rapids in particular has suffered from prolonged block crossings issues with these trains. The line going up to Duluth is affected. The line going west to through Wayzata is affected. The two subdivisions going through St. Paul are affected. Everything comes to a stop because of this situation. So the solution that we had come upon was to build this connector. A couple weeks ago, a couple of our executives came up from Fort Worth to check the situation. We walked the track. We drove it. We met later with Senator Rest, with members of the governor's staff, Department of Transportation, and we said that we'll take a look at options. We'll see if we can find something that's more palatable. But at the same time, this is the only solution that we know works. And what's happening now is the one workable solution is being taken off the table. And then comes the question, what if Hennepin County doesn't like Plan B? They don't like Plan A. What if Plan B has something that they don't like, and there's an eminent domain issue in that? Or some other county down the line is not going to like something. The rail industry loses the ability to do projects that are necessary for the state economy. That's why the power of eminent domain was given. All states that have railroads have given railroads the power of eminent domain. It's been on the books for years. There's nothing unique about the situation in Minnesota with the rail industry having it. What would be unique would be one county being allowed to kill a project that has ramifications for the entire state's economy and affect communities not only within that county, but other counties as well. It's not moving a prolonged block crossing situation from one place to another. What it's doing is creating a more fluid operation. We've said all along that the key to solving the block crossing issues is fluidity of the system, and that these capital projects were designed to do that. And so that's what we're attempting to do, and this bill would kill our ability, perhaps, to do anything to solve the problems of block crossings that exist already, and also kill our ability to solve the service issues that have put a crimp in the Minnesota economy in the last year. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what do you say to the communities that are telling you that you're blocking off their emergency exits and you're making their communities unsafe?
Sir, go ahead.
And Chair, Representative, we haven't even put a project together yet. We haven't filed an application. We haven't had these conversations. There has been a strong reaction to a project that hasn't even been presented yet. There is a process when the plan is filed. We have to get a permit from the Surface Transportation Board, an arm of the U.S. Department of Transportation. That agency does a review of the safety offsets, the safety concerns and offsets that would be part of any permitting process. They have a public input process, an environmental assessment, or EIS, depending on their determination, that looks at these issues.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right, but you're talking about a future project. I'm saying that right now what you're doing in their community is not safe.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Sweeney.
Madam Chair, Representative, the trains are already going over crossings in the Twin Cities. They are being parked for prolonged periods of time in some locations right now. Last night, the fire chief from Coon Rapids was talking about the problems that he has had. We're trying to resolve those problems by having the trains be able to move in a more fluid motion. They would be going through these communities at about 25 or 30 miles an hour, as opposed to being at a dead stop someplace else.
Any other member questions? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair. One thing, I was looking at the maps that provided, and when you do the present your plans, sometimes those plans require to proceed with a require an overpass or something be built to do a plan like this. I'm looking at the crossing on Corvallis Avenue. Sometimes with the transfer at the federal level, would they sometimes require, if it's a public safety issue, you require a bridge over the grade?
There is a possibility. I know that in Robbinsdale, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, that is a possibility. I know that in Robbinsdale, for example, it would be very difficult to try to shoehorn an overpass in there.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just appreciate your testimony. I guess I would like to hear a response from maybe Commissioner Johnson from the Hennepin County. If his testimony seems to state we're being a little preemptive here, and I guess I'd like to hear point counterpoint. Somebody told me once, listen to both sides of the story. Can't remember where I read that.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, and Representative Grunhagen. We are being preemptive. That's kind of the point here, before it's too late, when we can't do anything about it, which is, I've heard many a story over the years of people who can't fight the railroads, so to speak, because it's just too late to do it. And so this is preempting that from happening. And for me, we can talk about the specifics of any particular deal all we want, but it goes back to the principle for me. We are saying that, this change says that if you have a dispute over eminent domain, the elected officials are going to have the edge over the unelected officials. And to me, that's good policy, whether it's just Hennepin County or statewide.
Representative
Boonhagen. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So basically, if we pass this bill, it doesn't mean you can't negotiate with the railroad yet, right?
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, absolutely not.
It just puts you in a stronger position to weigh in on public safety in that negotiations.
Madam Chair. And Representative Boonhagen, yeah, the bill actually requires that there be a public safety issue for us to be able to stop the eminent domain.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson. We just heard the railroad talk about some of the congestion areas that they help relieve. And one they mentioned is my area. And it's not in Hennepin County. And I understand your concern with the public safety issues down there. And that we can bring in intimate domain to stop the project that would actually relieve the public safety issues in my district. So I'm a little concerned on that because of that.
Commissioner Johnson, Representative Anderson, I think you had something you wanted to say. Sorry about that.
Sure. Well, just a couple of things in response to what Mr. Sweeney has said to us here tonight. BNSF went ahead and they approached the owners to purchase the land. So when we've been told that they didn't have any plans, they clearly had plans in place. They took the approach to ask the owners to purchase their property, but did not communicate with any of the local elected officials, not the city officials, not the county officials, or anyone that would have a stake in public safety. They conducted surveys. They also made a last offer to the owners of that property, and so they are fully engaged. They have a plan, regardless of what you heard here tonight. And what I found most interesting is in the Transportation Committee, we were told that this wasn't going to actually increase traffic, but here tonight we heard that it is going to have 12 more trains. It'll allow them to have 12 more trains. So whether that's 12 more trains that are going to be pushed out to your area or 12 more trains that are going to be running through my district, we're hearing conflicting testimony on what's truly going to happen. And that's what gives me pause and concern, is that we don't really know what's going to happen. But if we at least have this bill in place, as Commissioner Johnson pointed out, it gives the folks the leverage to be able to say, we want to have a seat at the table. And I think all of us have had experiences within our communities that says that we need to have that kind of leverage, that we need to be able to have that opportunity to speak to the issues of public safety for the people that we represent. And Commissioner Johnson said it very well. This puts it in the hands of the elected officials who are held accountable to the citizens of Minnesota versus non-elected officials. And I think that that's the better approach to go overall.
Any other member questions? Thank you for your testimony, and I'll find my script here. I will renew my motion that House File 1467 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The committee is adjourned.